Raven's End, Part 5, Summer. Chapter 1.
Uncle Colin! Uncle Colin!
Hey, it's Uncle Colin!
Quit shoving!
Colin! Colin!
Packed into Molly and Zach's nest, four young ravens shouldered one another aside to see their favorite bird in the flock.
"Hi there, you bunch of big-billed beggars," Colin said as he landed.
He used the ravens' term of endearment for their young beggars.
Big-billed was a hint, happily received, that he had brought them something to eat.
"Colin, what did you bring us?"
"Colin, show me some more about flying."
"Colin, guess what I did today?"
"Colin, Colin!"
"Me too, me too."
Molly was sitting on a corner of the ledge looking tired. She was glad to see Colin because he would entertain her nestlings for a while and get them out of her feathers.
"Oh, Colin," she called above the noisy voices, "how nice of you to drop by."
"Well, I missed them yesterday," he said, preparing to poke some food into each wide open gape.
"Okay, who's first?"
"Me, me,
me, me,
me too."
He stuck his bill into the closest receptacle.
"Gargle, gargle,
yum, yum."
Colin had brought the nestlings a crop full of elk guts. He fed the next, until all four had stopped clamoring. They laid their heads on the edge of the nest and gazed rapturously at Colin. He smiled back. They really looked like ravens now. Their bodies were fully covered in sleek black plumage. Their wing feathers had grown in, and so had their long tail feathers, which kept swiping across one bill or another as the birds turned around in the nest. This would often start a squabble.
"Hey, you whacked me again."
"Did not."
"Did so."
"Kids, kids." Their eyes were gray rather than nestling blue. Soon they would be known as grays, the raven word for fledglings. One day their eyes would be as brown as those of their parents. But to earn the title of gray, Molly and Zach's children would have to do the most daring thing they would attempt in their entire lives. Over the next few days, each of these young birds would jump from the nest way up on Yamnuska's sheer south face and try to fly. This is what Colin was here for. In preparation for the leap, he was providing the training. Zach usually taught this vital topic, but the kids loved Colin so much, and he was such a fine flyer, that Molly didn't mind if he stood in as instructor. After all, she noted wearily, the nestlings paid more attention to him than they did to their own parents.
"Okay," Colin was saying, "who can tell me the last thing you do before you jump?"
"Get your wings out! Get your wings out!"
"No, that's not it. Your wings are already out. It's something else."
"I know, I know."
One bird was flapping excitedly, trying to get Colin's attention.
"Yes, Zolly?"
Zolly was the brightest in the brood. Zach and Molly hadn't been able to decide at first if she was male or female. The sex of young birds is so hard to tell apart that even their parents sometimes have trouble. And thus they had delayed naming her. Colin had noted the problem and suggested Zolly, a combination of Zach and Molly. Zolly spoke in a strong, clear voice.
"You always look both ways before you jump."
"That's right, Zolly. Look before you leap."
Zolly smiled and looked smugly at her siblings.
"You're such a goody-goody, Zolly,"
said one of the other nestlings. Another one defended her.
"Just 'cause you couldn't think of it, and she could poop feathers." "Ooh, I'll get you for that."
"Kids, kids."
Molly was looking forward to the day her whole brood was safely on the wing. Colin got their attention again. "Now," he said, "let's practice the jump together. Everyone up on the edge of the nest." The young raven stepped to the rim. They gripped the twigs tightly, looking uneasily into the void below. "Okay, wings out." They all spread their wings, bumping into each other. "Now, flutter." They flapped in short strokes, hitting each other on the head, but concentrating too much to notice. "That's it. Good flutter." They fluttered harder, stirring up the dust on the ledge. A panicked beetle scuttled away around the corner. "Now, pick a point to aim at. Pick something in the scenery ahead of you and slightly below." They did, their eyes wide. "Now look both ways. Always look both ways." They looked. The fluttering was very fast now. "And away you go." On other days, that would have been the end of it. No one would have leapt. The young birds would have furled their wings and gabbled excitedly that soon they were going to follow through and leap. Soon, really soon, but not right now. Today, though, one of them did. "Zolly!" Molly exclaimed. There was Zolly fluttering out into space. Colin had known this might happen. He was expecting it, in fact, and no sooner had Zolly left the ledge than he was in the air himself, right beside her. "Good, Zolly! Good launch!" She had lost some height, but now she was gaining it back, wings beating furiously as she drew away from the ledge. "This is really great," she said in a frightened voice. "Okay, Zolly, you're doing fine," Colin reassured her. "We have to keep this first flight short so you don't get too tired." He watched her carefully. "Remember how I told you to turn? Twist your tail left and warp your right wing." She did, skidding a bit as she swung around to face the cliff.
"Like that? Like that, Uncle Colin?"
"Yes, yes, just like that. Very good." Zolly seemed assured of completing her first flight successfully. But Colin knew that the next part was the hardest. What if she couldn't get back on the nest? What if she struck the wall? What if... Then Zolly reached the ledge. She reached it too well, actually, and flew right into the nest, crashing into her brothers and sisters. They squawked and laughed.
"Zolly, Zolly, you flew! You flew!"
"What was it like, Zolly? What was it like?"
Zolly lay in the center of the nest, surrounded by the others.
It was like super,"
she panted some more. "It was harder than I thought, okay, and I had to flap really hard, but, oh, I want to do it again."
And she did, this time executing a better landing. She would have tried yet another flight, but Colin warned her not to. She seemed to be tiring. Molly enforced the warning. "Zolly, dear, if you can't make it back to the ledge, you'll have to flutter way down the face and roost all by yourself. And that wouldn't be very much fun, would it?"
"No, Mum,"
Zolly shivered, the very thought. "So why don't you lie down and rest for a while? Maybe someone else would like to try." Molly looked at the other nestlings.
"Not me. Not me either." "Well, maybe I would."
"Hey, yeah, Harry, we'll watch. Go, go."
And Harry repeated Zolly's performance, with the difference that Harry figured one flight was enough. In fact, that was enough flying for the whole brood. Worn out by the thrill of fledging, whether or not they actually flew, they were all soon asleep. Zack arrived with a crop full of ants to find that the intended recipients were dreaming away. "What's this?" he asked. "Everyone napping at this time of day?" "They've had too much excitement, dear,"
said Molly. Two of them fled just before you arrived.
Hey, Zack looked proud. Which ones?
Zolly and Harry, Colin said.
I knew it. Zolly for sure. She's so quick at everything. And Harry, too. Right behind her, no doubt.
He looked at his offspring. As always, they slept in a pile. Occasionally, one would wiggle, and the pile would readjust without waking up. These are great little beggars, Colin said. I mean, Grays in Zolly and Harry's case.
Yes, indeed, Zack beamed. Grays already. They grow up so quickly.
Colin was here when they fledged, Molly said. He helped them.
Zack smiled at Colin. That's good. No better flight instructor than Colin. He looked squarely at his friend. It's hard to believe that less than a year ago you crash-landed into our lives, Colin Ceci.
Colin reflected. Yes, it had been almost a year. And what a year! So many adventures, so much that was scary, so much that was interesting, so much that was happy and sad, and such a great number of changes. It was almost as if he had lived his whole life in less than a year. Then the chronic question came into his mind. The disturbing question that was always there, waiting just under the surface. What about before that? Always his thoughts would be interrupted by this gap in his memory, this hole in his existence. It was getting more and more distressing. He would have to ask Greta about it.
Colin!
Molly was fairly shouting at him.
Huh? Oh, sorry, Molly. I was thinking about something else.
Colin, you didn't respond at all. I thought you might be having one of your dreams or something.
No, he sighed, but I wish I would.
Wish you would have a dream? Said Zack.
Wish I could decide what to do, Colin replied. He hopped to the edge of the ledge and unfurled his wings.
We'll see you tomorrow, he smiled. And in the morning I'll tell everyone at the flap about Harry and Zolly.
Thanks, said Zack.
Bye for now, said Molly, turning to her young ravens. They were waking up. Say goodbye to Uncle Colin, kids.
Bye, Uncle Colin,
they all said together.
Bye-bye, you beggars.
And you two Grays, he added, smiling at Zolly and Harry. They looked well pleased with themselves. Then the nest erupted.
Mummy, Mummy, I'm really, really hungry.
Can we eat now, Daddy?
Feed me, feed me.
Me too, me too.
Colin stepped off the ledge and into the dependable south face updraft that had helped many a fledgling survive its first flight. He stretched out his big adult wings and soared, feeling his body rise with the vertical wind. He flexed his wingtips ever so slightly, noting with pleasure how the slightest adjustment had exactly the right effect, turning him a little this way, a little that way. Yes, he thought, flying was the greatest thing in the world. He looked down. Below him, he knew, were hundreds of creatures without wings. Coyotes, bighorn sheep, elk, chipmunks, and ground squirrels. The pikas in the rocks and the beavers in the brooks. What a privilege it was to fly. How lucky to have been brought into the world as a bird. Then the same thought that troubled him at Molly and Zack's nest struck again. He had to know, that was all. He had to find out, and soon. A raven needs to know where he came from, he said out loud. Then he went to find Greta. Chapter 2. Greta, I need to ask you something. Since that is what Colin spent most of his day doing, this was nothing new.
But the urgency in his voice told Greta that the upcoming question was special.
"Ask away," she said.
"Sorry to bother you so late, Greta."
"Oh, no bother, Colin. Go ahead."
Her reply rang a little false. It was dusk, and she hoped that Colin wouldn't pester her for long. She became very tired on the long summer days and needed her roosting time more than the other birds.
"One thing Zagadina said," he began, invoking a name seldom uttered on Yamniska, "was that she knew about my flock. My original flock, Greta, from before I came here."
"And you thought she was telling the truth?"
"Well, no, I guess not." Colin let his head drop. "She must have been lying, just trying to get me to stay, so she could give me that poison."
"But tell me, Colin, what did she say about your flock?"
Colin brightened. "She said it was the Maline flock, whatever this Maline place is, and that they were really strong birds and great flyers, and..."
"You'd like to believe that, wouldn't you?"
Greta's voice was kind, but Colin could tell she was patronizing him.
"Oh, Greta, I'd just like to know."
He looked out into the dimness. Evening's violet was creeping in behind the sunset. Colin could see the other raven's enders circling, letting the southerly wind carry them back to the south face after the evening flight. Greta hadn't attended the flight for some days now, and tonight Colin hadn't taken part either.
"Greta," he said, clenching his bill, "I have to know where I came from. I do."
"Well, as far as this Maline flock is concerned, quit worrying about it. There isn't one."
"Not at all?"
Colin looked hurt. Greta could be so blunt.
"Nope."
"But where is Maline?"
"Oh, Maline is a real place. It's a big lake in the Rockies, way north of us, around Jasper."
"Jasper?"
"A town, kind of like Banff. It's in the park, too. Ask Scratch and Wheedle about it. They've been there."
"Are there ravens there?"
"Yes, there are. Well, they have their own flock. Far-roaming bunch, too."
Greta looked thoughtful.
"In a way, Colin, Zagadina was right. The Jasper ravens really are great flyers. And they do roost sometimes at Maline Lake."
"But there's no separate flock called Maline?"
"No."
"Greta, this whole thing is really bothering me."
"I can see that."
"What should I do?"
Greta looked closely at Colin. His eyes showed his desperation. She spoke softly, and on a topic that Colin was not expecting.
"Colin, did I ever tell you how I came to join the Raven's End flock?"
No. What was this about?"
"Well, I arrived in much the same way you did."
"By falling out of the sky?"
She chuckled. "No, no, not by falling out of the sky. But I, too, had my troubles. I came from Waterton, and that's way south of here. I'm just kind of exploring northward. And I got caught in a bad downdraft while I was trying to cross the Bow Valley."
She looked in that direction, pointing with her bill.
"Got slammed into Lookout Mountain pretty hard. Practically crawled across Morley Flats to Yamniska."
"Were you badly hurt?"
"Yes. Couldn't talk sense for days. Actually broke the last joint on my left wing."
"Rock," Colin sympathized.
"But the Raven's Enders were good to me. A couple named Max and Margaret took me in. Wonderful birds.
They're gone now, both of them. And they kept me fed till I could fly again. Very generous, those two, like the rest of the ravens and flock. Wouldn't have made it without 'em.
Same for me with Molly and Zack, but... Cullen still couldn't catch the drift of the conversation. Greta never brought up anything without a reason, but what was the reason this time?
Greta, I don't see what this has to do with...
It has everything to do with...
Her old wheezy voice had taken on an edge.
Now, listen carefully, Colin Cece. The flock places a certain value on me.
Oh, Greta, the flock couldn't do without you. They really couldn't.
And they learned that it pays to be kind to strangers. Not that it paid with Dolus and Garth, but still...
She drifted into thought. And, Colin prompted.
And I have dreams, too, you know.
Colin's eyes widened. So that was it. She, too, must have been looking for her past. He had to ask her. Greta, did you once forget where you came from? Like me?
No, I've always known where I came from.
Colin's head drooped. Oh, he said.
But my dreams have sent me searching for things. That's what I was doing when the downdraft got me.
Colin looked up again, his excitement renewed. Greta, I'd never known that you came here following a dream.
Yes, I did.
But did you ever go on to find the thing in the dream?
Yes.
You actually found it?
Yes, I actually found it. And you will too. And when you do, it will be very, very good.
The truth about myself?
Yes, among other things.
I wish I could be sure of that, Greta. Colin looked troubled again. How do you know I'll find out?
The same way you know things. They're from inside. From a place that other birds don't have.
The second sight place?
Yes, the second sight place.
Then what should I do, Greta? My second sight place hasn't told me any of this. It just makes me feel upset all the time. And the great raven is no help. She gets me all excited. Then she just leaves me here, worrying and fretting. And that dream about the mountain with feathers. A squawk came from somewhere else along the cliff, reminding Colin that other birds were trying to roost. Colin pecked a rock under his feet. Pain traveled up his bill. It felt strangely good. Greta touched his wing.
You really are in a bad way, kiddo, she said softly. And it was just as hard for me. The things I used to do to my family and flockmates, oh, I was nasty at times. But try to calm down. This whole thing is going to resolve itself just fine.
Colin spread his toes against the rock of Yamnuska. The ancient limestone felt cool. He gathered himself for one last question. This would be his final question on the subject of his origin. He knew he couldn't stand to ask Greta about it again. He would phrase the question carefully, logically, so that Greta could not weasel out of a direct answer. It would be a simple yes or no sort of question. He stood quietly for a long time, thinking. At the end, though, he gave up. No question would provide a simple answer. He just blurted out the one thing that he needed to know at that moment. Greta, what am I going to do? She chuckled. Colin could have pecked her instead of the rock, but he didn't. Instead, he heard the words he knew so well.
Do what I always tell you to do, Colin. Pay attention.
Pay attention to your dreams, he finished, sighing. Well, that was that. He was never going to get a straight-on, forthright answer on this topic. Not from Greta. But this time, Greta's cryptic guidance was exactly right. That night, Colin had the most important dream of his life. Chapter 3. In the dream, Colin was going somewhere. The lay of the land was unfamiliar, peculiar even, the way it is in dreams, and his destination was unclear. But he knew he was trying to find something. There were other ravens in the dream, ravens and ravens. He kept seeing them. He would overtake them. Here was Wheedle flying in the same direction he was. Colin asked, "Where are you going?" And Wheedle replied, "Out the inside tree," which was nonsense, but it seemed reasonable in the dream. Sarah told him she was going home by way of the night flowers. It was scary, in a way. All the other ravens knew where they were going, but Colin did not. And he was definitely lost. He kept traveling anyway, watching the strange scenery roll by. Forests of moss as tall as trees, streams that ran along the tops of ridges. A growing feeling told him that this dream flight would take him to some extraordinary place. And it did. There, right in front of him, was the mountain with feathers. It was a dream mountain, and thus none too clear. But Colin could see the feathers well enough. They were actually layers of rock. Steeply tilted upward, the layers overlapped like the feathers in a raven's wing. Colin was ecstatic. "Oh!" he cried out. It's real! I'm there! I've reached it!"
"What? You're where?"
Colin opened his eyes. He was back on Raven's End, perched with Greta in the chilly, colorless light that hints of dawn. He was embarrassed. "I'm sorry, Greta. I've had a dream. Must have talked and woke you up." Already the dream was fading.
"Well, at least you saw it," she said.
The mountain with feathers. The image snapped back into his mind. She had seen it, too. Dear old Greta. Amazing old Greta, who could share his dreams. And how right she had been to keep reminding him to pay attention to them. Colin knew that he had to remember the vision of the mountain with feathers. He had to keep that picture in a safe place in his mind, because he was certain now that he was going to go looking for the real thing. He knew he would find his flock on the mountain with feathers. Morning was about to arrive. This very day, Colin decided, he would start his quest. "Greta," he said gently.
"Hmm?"
She blinked at the world and slowly stretched her wings. Then she looked at him.
"Good morning, Colin. Ready for another day of lessons?"
"Greta, I'm leaving, Greta." Her response was short.
"Sure,"
she said pleasantly. What a bird, Colin thought. She understood perfectly. "You don't mind if I go?"
"Not at all, Colin. When I was young, I too paid attention to my dreams. Still do."
"But our apprenticeship thing?"
"Our apprenticeship can take some time off for a holiday. I could go on teaching you forever, Colin. I love it, and you love it."
She turned to him and smiled.
"But you've got the basics now, most of them. There are a couple, one in particular, that I can't help you with."
"Do you mean the mountain with feathers business? I have to find out on my own?"
Yes. She stretched her wings farther. Has to be. She touched his bill with hers. I'm going to miss you, Colin.
I'm coming back, he said, returning the affection.
I hope you realize that you might not be coming back, she replied wistfully. She looked at him again. Be careful, Colin.
Her voice trembled. Colin thought about Greta's travels. She knew what dangers awaited a raven far from home. She had survived them.
You've always made it back, Greta. Yes. And I think you will too, dear Colin.
Colin realized that Greta was going to start crying. I'm off to the flap to announce this, he said, trying to sound firm. But his bill quivered.
I'll be along shortly. Goodbye, Colin.
Goodbye, Greta. He left the roost before he lost control completely. Chapter 4 It was a glorious morning for the flap. Summer sunlight flooded the rocks at Raven's End, and the subalpine firs clustered there smelled especially tangy. The night had been cool and without wind, giving the birds a better rest than they'd had in many days. They stretched their wings in the warmth and chatted contentedly. The main raven called the meeting to order. He asked Maya for the news. Her report was brief. First, the headlines. A small rock slide in the ruins yesterday destroyed 3 trees, 2 Engelmans and a pine, and left a family of nuthatches homeless. Beyond the killed trees, there were no other injuries. She stopped for a breath. The shrews report that insect larvae of all kinds are especially plentiful this summer.
Super yummy caterpillars, Brendan interrupted.
The main raven shot him a disagreeable look. Maya burbled on. Molly and Zach C.C. of the Raven's End flock report that 2 of their nestlings fledged yesterday. The ravens cheered. Colin remembered that he was going to announce this for Molly and Zach, but Maya had found out first, of course. Well, she had saved him from having to make 2 statements to the flock this morning. Now he had to deliver just one.
Thank you, Maya, the main raven was saying, nodding his bill as he walked about in the center of the circle. And now, are there any complaints?
There were none. All the birds had been getting along well lately. Garth had lived up to his promise. The change was remarkable. He was now friendly toward everyone, and he behaved very responsibly. Brendan and Sarah had become his best friends, and the 3 of them were together all day long. The main raven was just about to call for the motion and adjourn when Colin spoke up. CC's. I have an announcement. He sounded so formal that it surprised the other birds. They turned toward him expectantly. I will be leaving the flock for a while. This caused a commotion.
No, Colin, don't go.
No, no. Stay, Colin, stay.
Order, order.
The main raven had to flap his wings to quiet the circle.
We're sorry to hear that, Colin. Please tell us the reason for your proposed absence.
Colin stepped forward and looked at the other birds. His friends, every one of them. He spoke slowly.
I have had a dream, he said.
The circle tightened. Colin was famous for his dreams. What was this one about? It must have been important if he was leaving because of it. And the dream has shown me an image of a mountain I must find. Not a feather rustled in the flock.
So I'm going to look for it. I hope to be gone only a little while, maybe just a day or 2. But if it takes longer, please don't worry about me.
He stepped back into his place in the circle. Marg spoke next.
not worry about you, Colin will worry the whole time. All the other birds joined in again, begging him to stay.
Wait, everyone.
It was Greta, joining the flap late.
Well, let's be fair here. You're just making it harder for Colin to do what he has to do. Part of him really doesn't want to go because he loves you all so much.
Here she looked around at the flock.
But I know how he feels. Been on a few trips myself, you know.
She smiled.
And I've always come back, haven't I?
The other birds nodded. Yes, she had always come back.
So I think we should wish him well and not make him feel guilty about leaving.
Greta's right, said Marg firmly. A bird has to do what she has to do. Go where she has to go. That's one of the three freedoms.
Hey, yeah, Brendan interrupted. A raven can, like, fly anywhere he wants, right?
Yes, Brendan, Marg continued. And Colin is now making a choice that is hard for everyone concerned. But it's one we will have to live with. The main raven agreed.
Well said, Marg. I think we should close the subject now and adjourn the meeting with a special motion to wish Colin a safe journey and a short one, so that he returns to us as soon as possible.
Hear, hear!
The motion, then?
The ravens made their wheel. Wing to wing, they each took a deep breath of clean morning air and used it to bring forth their familiar call. It was a special one this day, in recognition of Colin's daring intent. They sent him off with their strength, their goodwill, and their confidence that they would see him again.
Rakata!
Colin didn't wait to explain further. He spread his wings and departed. Chapter 5. But where was he to go? Colin didn't have the slightest idea of where to look for the mountain with feathers. It couldn't be to the east, he knew, because there were no mountains to the east. To the east lay the foothills, which were low and gentle. He would have to search to the west, he decided, toward Carrot Creek and Banff. He would get to Banff, climb very high, and from up there he'd get a good view of everything. Maybe he would see it.
And if you don't? Came a voice from nowhere.
The great raven.
Then I'll just keep going, Colin replied. Good plan. The voice of the great raven sounded pleased.
Hey, maybe you can help me.
Colin realized that the great raven probably knew exactly where the mountain with feathers was.
Do you know about the mountain with feathers?
Yes, of course.
Hey, terrific! Where is it?
The voice chuckled. That is, as they say, for me to know and for you to find out.
Oh,
Colin's wingbeats slowed. But I'll tell you this, Cece.
Yes?
You're on the right track.
Colin's wingbeats picked up again. He was going to get some help after all.
Thanks.
My pleasure, said the great raven. And then she added quickly, but keep in mind, Colin, that this is your adventure. I'll check on you occasionally, but I can't be with you often. I've got a lot of other things to do, too.
I'm sure you do.
So, good luck. Keep those strokes steady.
I will, I will.
Goodbye for now. And the voice was gone.
Colin raced toward Banff. He flew high, looking to right and left, hoping to recognize the image in his dream. What he saw were the front ranges of the Canadian Rockies, ridge upon ridge. Off to the southwest were several big peaks, Mount Joffre, Mount Sir Douglas, and the Royal Group, each shining with glaciers.
The lesser summits had lost their winter snow, but not these. Still, despite their impressiveness, none looked like the mountain with feathers. Then, directly ahead, Colin saw Mount Assiniboine. Highest in the region, Assiniboine stuck up like a fang on the horizon. Here was a truly grand mountain, Colin thought. It stood head and shoulders above everything around it. He increased his speed, hurrying to get a closer look. But a little while later, when he was near enough to see some detail on the peak, he had to admit that Mount Assiniboine could not be the mountain with feathers. The rock layers did not overlap the right way. Weary now and somewhat disheartened, he flew on more slowly. It was mid-afternoon when Colin landed in the parking lot at the Banff Hot Springs. There, strutting around, were the Banff Ravens. Colin called, alighting a little distance off. Two of the birds turned toward him and began to hop over. One was large, the other small. Colin didn't hesitate. He addressed the big one. "My friend," he said respectfully. "Perhaps you remember me from last winter. My name is Colin C.C. from the Raven's End flock." Surprisingly, it was the smaller bird, a female, who replied. "Oh, Colin C.C.," she said, striding right up to him. She flashed her neck feathers. "I would like to take this opportunity to welcome you to the Banff area. I would also like to take this opportunity to introduce myself. My name is Claudia C.C., and I presently hold the position of Main Raven here in Banff." She tossed her head up and down as she spoke. She said each word precisely, the way adult ravens speak to nestlings and fledglings. "I'd like you to meet my assistant, Scurf C.C. Scurf was the raven, Colin realized, who had beaten Dolus in the fight at the parking lot. Claudia continued before either bird could speak. "Scurf does my coordinating," she said. "He reports directly to me." She turned to Scurf. "I wish to know whether Colin C.C. was the Yamnuska raven involved in that unpleasantness we had here at the hot springs last winter." Scurf looked Colin over carefully and replied, "No, it was a different one." Colin explained, "Oh, that was Dolus, C.C. He's dead." "I'm sorry to hear that. What a shame. Did he die in a violent manner?" "Yes." "How unfortunate. Well," she fluffed her neck feathers out again, "may we assume that you were on your way to some other area? Vacationing, perhaps?" Colin didn't know what vacationing was, but he assumed that it had something to do with traveling. To be agreeable, he replied, "Well, that's right. Won't be here long. Just stopping for a bite to eat." Colin hadn't checked the parking lot for goodies yet, but as he looked around, he saw that the garbage barrels were overflowing. "How nice," Claudia said, her bill opening wide with each word. "Well, we have plenty to share here with our tourist visitors, as long as they don't stay too long, of course." "Of course." Colin fluttered his feathers like a nestling about to receive food, which was the proper response. He wondered what a tourist was. Claudia told him before he could ask. "Oh, we welcome tourists like you here in Banff. Tourism is a critical factor for us in terms of our flock. We just love visitors, and we make sure that all our friends from other, less attractive parts of the world get right into the spirit of Banff." Her voice had been rising in pitch and becoming more and more excited as she spoke. She finished with a sugary squeak. "And you're invited!" The big raven now spoke. He seemed more down to earth. "What she's saying is that we're about to have our flap. Would you like to join in?"
"Well, I..."
"We don't eat until after the flap," Scurf added. Oh, I see. Sure, I'd love to attend your flap. This was interesting. It seemed that the Banff Ravens had their flaps in the afternoon rather than in the morning.
I'm so pleased that she'll join us. Claudia raised her head high and called the other birds together. CCs, round and round club, gather here, birds, by me.
The others came hopping and fluttering over. One of them seemed particularly keen. He got there first and spoke to Claudia.
Then eats, right?
This bird wasn't very large in the usual sense, not very long or tall, but he was big nonetheless. Looking at him again, Colin realized that what he was seeing was a fat raven.
Yes, Dave. First the meeting, then refreshments.
Claudia waited until the birds were assembled. They didn't stand as close together as the ravens Anders did at their flaps.
Good afternoon, CCs, and welcome to today's Round and Round Club, she said in her bubbly voice.
She paused, obviously enjoying the attention the other birds gave her. Then she poked her bill in Colin's direction.
I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce you to Colin C.C. of the Raven's End flock. He has stopped in on his way. Where did you say you were going, Colin?
West.
On his way west. I have invited him to join our flap, the Round and Round Club, on this occasion.
She glanced about, smiling sweetly.
So, let's get started.
The format was rather like the Amnuska flaps, Colin noted, except that this main raven seemed to do all the talking. She gave the news, not as well as Maya, he thought, and she presented, her word, to the other birds on a number of topic areas, boring stuff about what she'd been doing the day before, mostly. She said, in terms of, a lot. No one else was invited to speak or even given a chance. Then she called for the motion.
Our next priority, she said brightly, is to utilize all our voices to their fullest and have a really great motion, a super Banff motion in honor of our guest, Colin C.C. Let's do a motion any flock of ravens would just envy.
She opened her bill so far on this last word that Colin thought it might stick that way. Colin assumed that the other birds would form a circle around Claudia. He expected that they would spread their wings, so he stepped back to give them room. But he was completely surprised by what happened next. Each bird shut its eyes and turned around several times. As it did, it made a string of sounds that Colin had never heard before.
Coo-coo-coo, coo-coo-coo.
What in the world? Colin felt himself starting to laugh. he said, stifling the impulse.
Did you like our motion? Claudia asked, hopping over to him.
Oh, yes, it's really different, isn't it?
Of course, she said, beaming. Everything we do here at Banff is very creative.
Where did you get this fascinating motion?
Oh, I have to thank myself for that. And my Tourism Action Committee adopted it immediately, of course. No other flock has anything like it in terms of flock motions.
She smiled.
Why, we're the talk of the mountains. Ravens come from all over just to see it.
No doubt they would, Colin thought gleefully. They wouldn't believe it otherwise.
And now it's your turn.
What?
Your turn to make the motion.
Oh, I'm not sure I really should. Colin wasn't part of the Banff flock. Why was Claudia asking him to make their motion?
It's customary, she said. We expect it of all our visitors.
She said this without smiling, and Scarf moved a step nearer to Colin. His tufts were ever so slightly raised. All the other birds were watching.
Okay.
Colin turned around a couple of times.
Coo, coo, coo.
Claudia smiled broadly. Very good, Colin, very good. Don't you just feel the spirit of Bav? What Colin felt was ridiculous. But if he had to do this to get something to eat, and with that big raven making sure he did it, well, it was over now. Claudia turned to address the rest of the flock, which was waiting silently for her to adjourn the meeting.
Okay, then, flock members, let us move to the dining facilities.
The other birds hopped over to the garbage barrels, with the one called Dave in the lead. He didn't hop, Colin observed. He waddled very quickly. Colin joined him at one of the barrels, saying, well, I'll stand watch up top if you want to go in.
Hey, great, really great.
Dave flapped heavily up to the edge and flopped in. Right away, Colin could hear the sound of Dave's bill crunching up something. Dave talked as he ate.
Sweet life we got here in Banff, he said, gulping down French fries. Thanks to humans. I love humans. They make life so easy.
Peck, peck.
Too easy, really. No need to look far for goodies around here.
Gobble, gobble.
I don't recall having to leave town for food in I don't know how long.
Scrunch. Gulp.
But it can mess you up. Hey, I'm so fat, I probably couldn't fly to the top of Mount Rundle if I wanted to.
Peck, peck, gulp.
Claudia's trying to get us to cut back. She won't let us start until the afternoon.
Colin waited what he thought to be an appropriate length of time. Then he said, Dave, when do I get some?
Huh? Oh, okay, I'll trade with you.
Colin jumped down to the bottom of the barrel. It was empty. A ruptured packet of ketchup stuck to one of his feet.
Dave, there's none left.
Are you sure?
Colin hopped back up to the rim and looked Dave in the eye.
Yes.
Dave didn't say anything. He flew off to another barrel. Colin watched him go, wondering how a raven could be so selfish. Well, at least there were other barrels. As he perched there, deciding which barrel to check out next, another bird landed beside him. Colin recognized him immediately.
Boogs!
And a right good morning to you, laddie.
It was the raven Colin had met here last winter, the one with the interesting accent and the charming way of speaking.
It's good to see you again, Cece. Aye, Colin, has it gone with ya?
Fine, only I'm still hungry because Dave there cleaned out the fries on the bottom of the barrel for me.
Aye, he'd day that, Rick. He'd day that.
Boogs looked around at the other birds.
Atween you and me, Colin, maist of them a day the same. The whole fat lot of them.
They are fat, aren't they?
Far too muckle around the middle, aye.
Colin laughed. Muckle, was it? Craha!
But how come they have a reputation for being tough, these Banff ravens?
Ach, well, they're hard, laddie, hard.
How so?
Fighters, that's what they are. Ach, they seem friendly enough, but then they tangle with them. They're quick on the peck, they are, and they ken just where to get ya.
Colin was watching Dave again. He had landed on a barrel occupied by another raven. As Colin watched, Dave and the other raven began to quarrel. Suddenly, Dave's bill shot out and pecked the other bird squarely on the knee joint. It flew off, its hurt leg pumping in the air.
See what they mean, laddie.
Boogs shook his head.
You'd think the hunger would make a bird mean-spirited. But when there's too much to eat, well, I ken it's worse. Ach, aye, it's far worse.
But isn't this your flock, Boogs?
Mine? Ach, it is, in a kind of way. But by the trees, Colin, in another way it is nae. I mostly live by myself at Mount Assiniboine. Still, I come to the toon often, you ken. He gave Colin a secretive look. This Banff lot, and that daft Rund and Rund club, they're entertaining, don't you think?
Colin laughed. This time he didn't have to hold it in. What is this cuckoo stuff, anyway?
Boogs looked amused. Och, that's nae the half of it, laddie. Dinna let Claudia ken I've telt you this, but I ken for a fact that she didna think of it by herself.
No?
Not a bit of it. Have ye ever seen pigeons, laddie? No, but I've heard of them. Pretty stupid, I'm told.
Hey, wait! He was beginning to understand. Greta told me that pigeons turn round and round.
By now, Boogs could hardly speak. He was laughing so hard. They say, they say, coo, 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 convulsed in merriment, the two birds couldn't hang onto the rim of the barrel any longer. They dropped down to the ground, where they simultaneously spotted a discarded hamburger. This was more important than the joke. Boogs deferred to Colin.
Go on, laddie. You're nae doot hungrier than I.
Thanks, Colin said, tearing off a goodly hunk. I really am ravenous. Having swallowed the chunk whole, he stepped back from the rest of the hamburger.
Help yourself. Et yamnuska we share.
Why, that's decent of ya, Boogs replied, taking a bite. The combination of food and bill and accent made his next statement incomprehensible to Colin, but he thought he caught a question in it.
Beg pardon?
Boogs swallowed.
I was asking ya where you're gone frae here, travelin' and that.
Colin wasn't sure what to say, but he figured that it wouldn't hurt to tell Boogs the truth. I'm looking for the mountain with feathers. Boogs dropped his next helping of hamburger meat.
What did you say, laddie?
The mountain with feathers. I'm looking for it. Noting Boogs's expression of surprise, he added quickly, you haven't heard of it by chance. Boogs looked thoughtful.
Well, maybe I have then.
Colin's eyes lit up. He waited expectantly as Boogs tried to remember.
I dinna ken if they called it that exactly, but I'd swear there's a mountain of that description to the north of here.
He stopped, apparently thinking again.
But I couldna tell you precisely where.
Colin was thrilled, despite the vagueness of the other bird's reply. Now he had a direction.
Boogs, thank you very much. You've helped me a lot.
Have
I? Yes, yes.
Colin quickly ate more of the hamburger. Leaving plenty for Boogs, he spread his wings.
You're for off already, are ya?
I'm not wasting any time.
If you're gone to fly north, up the Bow River, I'll tell you where there's a bonny wee roost.
And Boogs described the spot. He smiled.
Away what you knew. It'll be getting dark soon.
Goodbye, Boogs. Well, thanks again. Maybe I'll come by Mount Assiniboine sometime and see you.
Aye, I'll be looking forward to that, Colin. So I will. Fare thee well, laddie.
Colin hopped over to say goodbye to the main raven and thank her for her hospitality, which was the polite thing to do. Well, goodbye, Claudia C.C. Well, thank you for sharing your flock's food with me and your round and round club.
Oh, yes, goodbye, she said loudly, and we hope to see you in our Banff area again very soon, and tell everybody how much we like having visitors. Cuckoo!
As Colin took to wing and climbed out above the Hot Springs parking lot, he looked back at the scene. There were the Banff ravens, walking among the garbage barrels and standing outside car windows as food was thrown to them. A couple of birds squabbled over a bag of potato chips.
Strange bunch, he thought. He'd take the raven's enders any day. Boogs was right. Too much food was just as bad as too little. Soon the town was behind him, and he was flying into an unfamiliar landscape. The sun lay directly ahead, engaged in its long summertime slide northwestward. Its reflection flashed off the shallow waters of the Vermilion Lakes west of Banff. Beyond, he could see the Bow Valley making a turn to the north. Boogs had said that he was to follow the river toward a mountain made of three big layers. There were supposed to be two hard layers that formed cliffs, and a third one in the middle that was softer, forming a wide ledge. Castle Moonton, Boogs had called it, making Colin chuckle. Then he saw Castle Mountain itself far up the valley. He began pulling strongly for it. Chapter 6. Colin slept late the next morning in an alcove high on the cliffs of Castle Mountain. The sun was rising behind him, lighting up the mountains to the west, where range upon range of glacier-decked peaks stepped off to the horizon. Many of them were larger and higher than Yamnuska. Things were different here, he realized. He had traveled far enough west to leave the familiar front ranges behind. Now he was in the main ranges, the icy crest of the Canadian Rockies. Colin left his roost and continued north up the Bow Valley. He followed the river, stopping on the banks a couple of times for snacks, some willow catkins, a couple of trout fry he snapped out of a pool, and for a long drink of cold glacial water. At one of these stops, something across the river caught his eye. Here were two ducks diving and surfacing. They were the most beautiful ducks he had ever seen. He landed near them.
Oh, ducks!
Howdy, Raven.
The ducks were small but splendidly marked. Red, black, and white, they were boldly patterned.
Allow me to compliment you on your plumage, Colin said.
Thanks.
These were not stuffy types, Colin decided. Polite, but not at all formal. The ducks busily continued their work, diving below the surface and reappearing a moment later. Colin was impressed by the place in the river in which they worked. It was a rough section, full of boulders. The water roiled through excitedly, shouting and splashing. Colin had never seen ducks in such a rapid. One of the ducks emerged close by.
Quite a keeper under there, it said.
A keeper?
Yeah, had to go around twice before I could get free.
The other duck appeared. It shook water from its feathers.
Hoo-hoo-wee! Let's eddy out a while.
I'm up for that, the first one said. It pointed its bill toward Colin.
This raven here seems okay. You want to talk to it?
Sure. The two little ducks stood next to Colin on a rock.
What's a keeper? Colin asked directly.
Ah, you're not a paddler, are you? Well, a keeper is a wave that holds you down on the bottom. Lots of fun, but it can be trouble.
Colin had bathed in rivers, but he had never swum below the surface. The duck addressed its companion.
Hey, Willie, did you see any stoneflies under there?
No, did you?
Maybe. Believe I'll run it again.
Go for it, Toby.
The duck called Toby flew back out to a big boulder. Then, quick as a splash, it dived. The other duck watched approvingly.
Strong paddler, that one. Figures to make the Harlequin Championships this year.
Toby popped up again, eating something.
Hey, yeah, stoneflies for sure.
The duck named Willie turned briefly to Colin.
Gotta go. Good paddling to you.
Sure.
Yo, Willie, watch this.
The duck that had been eating now put its head under water and tilted its tail up. It held that position, legs pointed to the sky.
This looked to be difficult to do, given the white water pounding by.
All right, it's an endo!
Willie promptly did the same thing. On impulse, Colin stuck his head into the water, too.
Blub, brr, cold!
Shaking the water off, he looked over to the ducks. They were bobbing on the standing waves, gabbling away, their words lost in the roar of the river.
You can have it, guys, he called, lifting off.
They tilted their bills upward, acknowledging his departure. Chapter 7 Later that day, Colin cruised high above the Bow Valley. He could now see a very long way in any direction, with 100 peaks to choose from. Was one of these the mountain with feathers? He did a slow 360-degree turn, his long-distance raven vision probing the ranges for something that matched the image in his dreams. But there was no mountain with feathers. It was going to be farther north, he reasoned. It had to be beyond the distance a raven like Boogs would travel. And Boogs was no stay-at-home. Today, then, was for flying north, far and fast. And fly he did, wing beat after wing beat, all through the afternoon. He followed the valley, watching the Bow River dwindle to a small creek, upstream of all the tributaries that made it grow to the size of the river he knew, where it flowed by Amnuska. Hey, Amnuska. The thought made Colin homesick. He was very far from home now. Getting back would take just as long as it had taken him to get there. He would be faster on the way back, especially if the prevailing northwesterly wind were blowing. His homesickness turned to pride. On he went, into the next valley to the north, headwaters of an unknown river. This valley had a dark, malevolent look. The sunless walls were plastered with cold, gray glaciers. As he watched, a huge chunk of ice, bigger, Colin thought, than Raven's End, broke loose and fell. He veered away from the flying ice fragments, the sound shaking his body. Still, could one of these summits be the mountain with feathers? He circled over each peak as he passed it, but none corresponded to the picture in his mind. It's just as well, he thought. The whole place looked downright unfriendly, and there were no other ravens. Colin soared very high, so high that he could see all the way back to Mount Assiniboine, just barely discernible among the welter of ranges to the south. He looked north, toward the unknown. In the blue distance, he could see a great sweep of snow. It was bordered by huge peaks. Was the mountain with feathers one of those? Colin put his shoulders to the wind, his wings repeating the familiar motion. Forward, spread, down, back. Forward, spread, down, back. Hour after hour. 20,000 strokes brought him to the expanse of snow he had seen from so far away. Colin could hardly believe it. Here was more snow than he could have imagined, snow blanketing the mountains as it did in the winter. But this was summer. Greta had talked about glaciers with Colin, and she had showed him a small one in the mountains near Yamnuska. But this was the main raven of glaciers. Then he remembered that Scratch had described such a place, the Columbia Ice Field, which he and Wheedle had flown by before they arrived at Yamnuska. Colin cruised low over its surface, admiring the rolling whiteness. Something caught his eye. Something black in the snow. Then more black things, and more. Insects! Uncountable numbers of them, lying all over the ice field. Colin landed. Just before touching down, he noticed how cold it was near the snowy surface. It had been warm only a wing beat higher, hot even, as the sun's rays reflected off the snow and heated the underside of his body. But now, as he stepped onto the snow itself, the air felt as cold as winter. He walked over to a moth and looked at it. The moth's wings began to flutter weakly. It could not fly. Colin ate it. He saw a beetle nearby. Again, the beetle was not dead. Its legs moved slowly, as if they would stop soon. Colin ate the beetle, too. He realized that all these insects were numb with cold. Numb with cold and trapped here, unable to fly. What an opportunity for a raven! He started filling his crop. Flies, mosquitoes, a butterfly, another beetle. It was a banquet. It turned out to be a supper banquet. The more he ate, the more Colin relaxed, and the more he relaxed, the more he thought he had flown far enough that day. He began looking for a roost. The cold glacial surface offered none, so he flew toward the opposite edge of the ice field. There, a deep valley dropped away. He roosted atop a pillar of rock on a cliff that reminded him of Yamnuska. It was gray limestone, with many cracks and corners. Small trees grew here and there on the ledges around him, just as they did at Raven's End. Colin longed to be home. Maybe he would turn around and start back tomorrow, he thought. Maybe he would see it as he flew back. The idea comforted him somewhat, and he slept. Chapter 8. Boom! Colin snapped awake. The echoes of a thunderbolt were pealing down the valley. Hawk! The next lightning flash came dazzlingly close, with a simultaneous splitting sound that shook the rock he was perched on. Something had stung his feet. As he jumped into flight, lightning again lit the scene. Colin's roosting pillar was now tumbling down the mountain, adding its disintegrating crash to the roar of the storm. The sulphurous odor of shattered limestone came up to him on the wind, along with the scream of an Engelmann spruce torn from its ledge and smashed to pieces by the tumbling chunks of stone. Hail swept down out of the blackness, and the wind flung it hard into Colin's eyes. A gust caught him under his left wing and threw him sideways into the cliff. Ark! He regained control just in time to hear a boulder whiz past. Lightning struck again. Colin had been in thunderstorms before, but none like this. Instinctively, he tried to distance himself from the cliff. The last flash had pointed the way. He groped out into the maelstrom of the sky, where he would not be hit by rockfall or battered to death against the cliff. But the hail was firing right through his wing feathers. He would have to land, and it wasn't going to be easy. As each explosion of electricity lit the scene around him, Colin descended through the night, lower and lower, in a series of dives that kept his flying surfaces small. Suddenly he was among the treetops of the valley floor forest. He put on the brakes as hard as he could and stuck out his feet just in time to intercept a branch that might have broken a wing. Whew! Colin clung to the branch as the wind swung it back and forth. "We sure don't have storms like this on Yamnuska," he said aloud, shuddering. The only reply he got was another blast from the thunderheads above. Working his way down the tree in a series of fluttering hops from branch to branch, he reached the protective middle portion and moved in close to the trunk to roost. As always, the wind here was light, and the hail could not penetrate. He settled over his trembling feet. Morning couldn't come too soon. Chapter 9. When Colin next opened his eyes, he looked out into rain and fog. The storm had arrived in a rage the night before. but now it had mellowed into the gray boredom of an all-day drizzle. Colin sighed. He didn't feel like flying in such weather, and yet he didn't particularly care for where he was, either. He lifted his tail from the branch and directed a squirt of yesterday's insects at the soggy forest floor. The action fitted his mood perfectly. Maybe he would just start heading back to Yamnuska in the rain. But where was Yamnuska? In which direction must he fly? With growing panic, he realized that he had become disoriented in the storm. Not only that, he wasn't going to be able to get his bearings in this fog. Then he remembered that it was mist that had once offered him his first hint about the mountain with feathers. He could certainly use another vision of his goal right now. Would the mist provide it again? Colin tried. Hello, mist. No answer. Mist, this is Colin. Nothing. He reconsidered. The experience in the mist had been only the beginning. Later on, the great raven herself had spoken to him. Of course, he would contact a great raven for help and advice. Great raven, this is Colin, he said to the air. Can you hear me? I need you. Colin waited for an answer. The great raven had told him that she was often busy. He knew he had to be patient. At length, he called out again, louder. Great raven! This is Colin. I'm trying to reach you. This time he waited a very long time, perched miserably on his branch. He was wet and cold. His stomach was empty. His body hurt all over from the bruises inflicted by the hailstones. And the great raven wasn't responding to his pleas. Great raven, this isn't fair, he shouted petulantly. You got me into this. Now get me out. Still, there was no response, and with growing certainty, Colin realized that there wasn't going to be one. The great raven was paying no attention to him. He clamped his bill. All right, then. I'll just have to get back on my own. It was said in anger, and the anger carried Colin off his perch and out into the drizzle. Jolly well just do it on my own, he repeated, trying to sound like Zack. Zack was a bird who let nothing faze him. Well, he would be like Zack. First he would have to find something to eat. But he hardly knew what to look for in this kind of forest. It was far wetter and greener than the woods around Yamnuska. Small streams trickled between banks of moss among the trees. He saw nothing he recognized as edible, and there was no carrion odor on the wind. Yet there was a sweetish fragrance in the air. Colin raised his bill to distinguish it better. It wasn't the smell of subalpine fir, which was sweet in itself. No, this was something different, something that reminded him of berries. Colin dropped to the ground and began looking. Yes, there they were, low bushes with big round blueberries on them. Oh, yum, he exclaimed as he started in. A bellyful later, he was feeling much better. His soreness was going away. Well, maybe he wouldn't turn back after all. He'd come so far, too far to just give up and go home, leaving the great question in his life unanswered. And what would Greta think? What would the great raven herself think? He would continue his quest. He would fly north. The clouds had lifted a little. Colin could see that the valley stretched off in both directions, like a long trough, the upper walls hidden by the low ceiling. He had the choice of flying either way in that valley. One way might take him northward toward the mountain with feathers. The other would take him back in the direction in which he had come. Well, it doesn't really matter which way I go, he reasoned aloud. if I go the wrong way, I'll come to the glacier again. And if that happens, I'll just turn around. So... He was stopped in mid-thought by a strange feeling. The second sight feeling. Something appeared there, dark and foreboding. Something shapeless, something unknown, something frightening. And it was coming his way. Cullen was off the ground in a wingbeat. Now he had a direction, away from whatever it was his mind's eye had seen. Fear drove him fast along the valley, and he covered a lot of distance in a hurry. After a while, he realized that the feeling was gone. He relaxed a little. But what had been the cause? Well, this time there had been no avalanche, no flock member lying unconscious under the snow. Maybe, he thought, it was just his imagination. Maybe this second sight thing played tricks on him occasionally. Regardless, he was certainly going the right direction, for otherwise he would have reached the glacier by now. His spirits lifted. All day, Colin flew northward, following a river that was the same glacial gray as the sky. The valley ran straight, and he seemed to be making good progress, although the low cloud cover hid any landmarks he might have seen on either side. By late afternoon, he estimated that he had flown about as far as he had been able to see from the Columbia ice field the day before. It wouldn't do to miss the mountain with feathers, so he considered waiting here for the weather to clear. But a hint of second sight fear crossed his mind at the thought, and Cullen kept going. At dusk, he found himself approaching a town. Worried that he might somehow have wound up back in Banff, he flew here and there looking for the big hotel full of humans, or for the hot springs. But he found neither, so he felt sure that this was not Banff. Could it be Jasper, then, the place Greta had mentioned? The place Scratch and Wheedle had visited on their way to Yamnuska? Tomorrow he would try to find out. Colin sought a cliff on which to roost, but the clouds had descended almost to the treetops, and the valley sides could not be seen. Colin settled into a tall pine on the edge of town. He slept uneasily. Chapter 10
"Who's this, then?"
Colin awoke to a dozen ravens landing on the branches around him. He said cautiously.
"Cece,"
came the pleasant-sounding reply. Colin fluffed out his neck feathers a little, to look assured but not arrogant, and introduced himself to what he assumed to be the local birds.
"I am Colin Cece, of the Raven's End flock."
"Colin," said the bird who had first spoken to him, "my name is Angie Cece, main raven of the Jasper flock." So this was indeed Jasper. He had made it all the way to Jasper.
"So where's Raven's End?" Angie asked. Her voice was kindly.
"On Yamnuska," Colin replied.
"And where's Yamnuska?"
Colin blinked. He was now so far from home that the ravens hadn't heard of Yamnuska.
"Yamnuska is along the mountain front south of here by 3 days of flying."
At this, several birds gasped. 3 days of flying? This Colin C.C. was a long-distance traveler. Angie spoke for them all.
"You've come a long way, Colin. What brings you to Jasper?"
Colin thought he might as well state it directly. "I'm looking for the mountain with feathers."
"Aren't we all?" said one of the ravens. "Aren't we all?"
"Beg pardon?"
The same bird replied. "I guess anyone who takes journeys like you do is looking for the mountain with feathers, eh?"
The raven gave him a knowing look.
But I doubt that you're quite ready to find it, right? At this, several of the birds laughed. What was going on here? Colin decided to try to straighten things out. I wonder if we're talking about the same mountain. The one I'm talking about is a sort of dream mountain. I see it in my dreams. That's why I'm looking for it. The other birds fell silent. They looked to their main raven. It might be the same one, Colin. Some of us believe that's where ravens go when they die. Colin twitched. Ravens go to the mountain with feathers when they die? He had never heard this before. Oh, was all he could say. He decided not to inquire further about the mountain with feathers right now. The Jasper Raven seemed strange, friendly enough, but strange, and he didn't want to offend them. So he asked the next question that was on his mind. Where does a raven get his breakfast around here? At the human cache, mostly, Angie said. We're just on our way there now. Care to join us? I'd love to. He fell in with the flock as they took to wing. He was surprised to discover that he was not stiff this morning, despite his long flights of the previous days. The farther he flew, the better his body seemed to like it. This day was just as cloudy as the one before. Colin had hoped to survey his surroundings from the air, but the cloud deck was too low. All he could see was the forest stretching off in every direction. Was he in a very wide valley? Was he even in the mountains at all? The cloud cover was so thick that he couldn't tell. The other birds noticed right away what a strong flyer he was. For every two flaps of their wings, he needed only one to cover the same distance, except for Angie, who seemed to be as strong as Colin. You're a fine flyer, Angie complimented. Well, thank you. It seems to make a difference if you go day after day. The birds were now over the town. Jasper was smaller than Banff, and it didn't seem to be as hemmed in by mountains as Banff was. That observation brought to mind the question Colin had when he arrived the evening before. Where do you roost, Angie, if you don't mind my asking? Oh, here and there. We've got several roosts. We use one, then another. Gets boring otherwise, you know. Colin told Angie that at Yamniska the ravens had their favorite perches and used them all the time. She seemed surprised. Well, I'd like to visit Yamniska sometime, she said. Well, see how ravens live in your part of the Rockies, though it's hard to take much of a break with this crew on my tail every day. The other ravens laughed. Colin could see that they genuinely liked their main raven. By this time, the flock had reached the place Angie had called the human cache. It was surrounded by a fence. Outside the fence lay a normal-looking forest with clearings full of wildflowers. But inside the fence, all was chaos. There were no trees, no shrubs, not even any grass. The earth had been gouged into raw-looking humps and hollows. Black bags full of something delicious lay in a pit, and a machine with a human on it was pushing dirt over the bags. The machine made a roaring sound, very loud, and dust followed it around. Also following it were dozens of gulls. Long-winged and white, they wheeled gracefully about. They seemed quite out of place in the cratered landscape inside the fence. Breakfast is served, Angie said as she glided over to the pit. Quickly she plunged her bill into a bag and ripped it open. Before the huge clanking machine could push dirt over both Angie and the bag, she made off with a rib to which nearly all the meat still adhered. Angie landed on the ground, well away from the machine, and began stripping the rib. As Colin watched,
The other ravens made their own attacks on the bags, scattering gulls as they landed. Each tore and tugged, retrieved something to eat, and flopped away with it. "I guess I'd better get in there," Colin said to himself. His first attempt failed. The machine bore down on him, and he had to fly away empty-billed. But on his next try, he came away with a bunch of grapes. "Mmm, sweet!" Colin croaked happily as he popped each one and let the juice run down his throat. Wow, these Jasper Ravens had it made! Angie hopped over to him. "You've got the hang of it, I see." "Anything to watch out for, besides that horrible whatever it is the human's on?" Angie looked over her shoulder at the machine. "Yeah, be very careful of that thing. We lost a flock member to it earlier this summer. It's slow, so you take it for granted. Then, crunch." Colin shuddered, imagining what it would feel like to be flattened under the treads. "I'll be careful, all right. Oh, and Angie?"
"Yes?"
"Why do you call this the human cache?" Angie threw his question back. "Haven't they got one at Yamniska?"
"Well, no, not really. What do the humans do with it?"
Angie gave Colin a look that told him he had just asked a very stupid question. But she answered it anyway. "Humans cache stuff here. You know, store it for later."
"Bury it in the ground, the way wolves do?"
Colin was catching on. He knew that wolves sometimes buried their meat, and he, like other ravens, often hid small items of food that couldn't be eaten at the time.
"Well, yeah, like wolves. Only they bury lots more than just meat, and they bury it really deep, and they..."
Angie hesitated. She looked puzzled. She glanced back at Colin.
"And, you know," she continued, "I just realized that I've never seen any of them dig it up again."
Angie closed her eyes, thinking deeply. "How strange. I'll have to ask somebody about it." Then she flew off to open another bag. Colin went back to eating. He had learned what this place was, and that was enough for now. How long the humans left their food cached was of no concern to him. They could leave it buried for a year, for all he cared. He laughed. No raven could wait that long to recover something he had cached. He'd have forgotten where it was. Kra-ha! After breakfast, Colin expected the flap. When it didn't occur, he asked Angie about it.
"Oh, the flap. We decided to combine the flap and the flight today. Sometimes we do that."
"Why today?"
"Well, because of you."
"Me?"
"Yeah. On the way to the flap, somebody spotted you, and everyone had to come right over. So much for the flap."
Colin nodded in agreement. It was easy to interrupt a flap at Raven's End, too. What surprised him was that Angie was taking it so well. The main raven at Yamniska hated having his flaps disrupted.
"Doesn't it bother you when something goes wrong with the flap?" "Ah, I don't care," Angie replied. "That's one less flap to have to referee. We'll get caught up this evening anyway."
"So you have your flights at sundown, just like we do?"
"Yep. Doesn't everybody?"
Another raven came up.
"Hey, Angie," he called. "Hey yourself, Kootenai."
The two birds touched bills. Angie looked toward Colin.
"Colin CC, meet Kootenai CC, my nestmate."
"Oh,"
said Colin.
"Oh,"
replied Kootenai. Then he turned toward Angie.
"Should we take him to see Uriah?" "Good idea. If there's anyone here who can help Colin, Uriah can."
"Who's Uriah?" Colin asked.
"The strangest bird you'll ever meet," Angie replied.
No stranger than Zygadina, Colin thought. And not as dangerous, he hoped.
Chapter 11. Colin, Kootenai, and Angie flew southeast across the Athabasca River, gray with rock flour from the glaciers upstream. A fish leapt from the milky water, alerting a nearby osprey to its presence. A moment later, the big bird had the fish in its talons. As Colin watched the osprey fly off to its enormous nest of sticks, he felt the first drizzle of the day. The three ravens were headed toward a side valley, where Colin could see a gorge. Angie got there first. She landed in a dead pine, overlooking the deep gash in the bedrock. The place reminded Colin of Carrot Creek Canyon, but this gorge was even narrower. And deeper, too. The bottom was mostly hidden between the overhanging walls. He could hear a river pounding through, pouring over waterfalls and raising mist. The mist sprinkled the sides of the gorge, keeping them wet and glistening. Colin felt himself both attracted to the gorge and repelled by it. He lifted his eyes from the spectacle in front of him and turned to the other birds. "This is a strange and beautiful place," he stated. "You bet," Angie said. "That's exactly what it is. Strange and beautiful. Precisely." "It's called Maligne Canyon," Kootenai offered. "Maligne? The name Zygadina had used?" Colin shivered. He stuttered out the obvious question. Do you know anything about a flock of ravens called the Maligne flock?" Angie surprised him with a laugh. "Sure, it's a flock of one. His name is Uriah." She looked up. "And here he is, the whole flock of him." She laughed again, and so did Kootenai, as a raven landed clumsily on the branch. He was a small raven, and an old one. His plumage was dull, and his feathers were tattered. His bill had several notches in it. As Colin noticed when the bird turned his head toward him, one eye was missing.
"Greetings all," said this odd-looking raven in a raspy voice. Then he turned to Colin. "Oh, my young friend, my name is Uriah C.C. Do I know you?"
He tilted his head this way and that, fixing Colin with his good eye.
No, my name is Colin C.C. I'm pleased to meet you." Colin wasn't sure how pleased he actually was.
"Colin is from Yamnuska," Angie said.
Yes, Yamnuska. Marvelous place. Terrific place."
"You've been there?"
"Yes, indeed. And everywhere else in these mountains."
Colin let his guard down a little. Uriah seemed to have a lot in common with Greta. Kootenai spoke next.
"Uriah, Colin is looking for something. We brought him along to you because we thought you might be able to help him find it."
"Help him? Of course I can help him."
He turned back to Colin and looked as if he were about to say something to him, but he spoke to Angie instead.
"Would you just like to leave him here with me for the afternoon?"
Colin started to object. I don't know that I... But Angie only laughed. "No worries, Colin. He's harmless. Aren't you, Uriah?"
"Yes, I suppose I am. By the trees, Angie, I hate being harmless. But you're right. I'm so old I have trouble pecking at bugs these days. Never mind pecking at another raven."
"You'll find him quite interesting," Angie added.
Colin wondered what he should do. The trap that Dolus had set for him with Zygadina had nearly taken his life. Could he trust Angie and Kootenai, whom he barely knew? And what about this Uriah, whom he knew not at all? He looked at the circle of birds. He looked at their eyes. He saw honesty in the eyes of Angie and Kootenai, and something else in the one eye of Uriah. He wasn't sure what it was, but at least it wasn't evil. Colin knew the look of evil. He decided to take a chance. Okay, I'm just kind of leery after a run-in with a very nasty raven earlier this summer. Uriah chuckled.
I should be just as leery of you, stranger.
He gave Colin the same sort of penetrating look that Colin had given him.
But I'm not, he said, smiling. These days I don't care much about myself at all.
We'll see you at the flight, Colin, Kootenai said. Look for us here at sundown, right over the canyon. It's one of our favorite places. He spread his wings. Bye for now, Angie called as she left the branch. Colin let out a gasp. Angie was free-falling into the gorge. But a moment later, Colin heard her croak, "Whee!" from the depths as she pulled up just above the water. Ah, that Angie, said Kootenai. She's such a daredevil. It's frightening to watch her.
Imagine what it must feel like to be her, said Uriah.
Chapter 12 Colin and Uriah sat together on the branch of a dead pine overlooking Maligne Canyon. Clouds had moved in, obscuring everything in fog. Light rain fell steadily. Neither bird said anything for a while. Then Uriah broke the silence.
Now then, Colin, tell me the worst thing that ever happened to you.
What? Colin had never been asked anything like this.
It's just to help me get to know you better.
Oh. This was a strange way to make an introduction. But Colin was willing to cooperate. Oh, let's see. Worst thing... Well, that was probably when I got shot by humans.
Shot? Tell me about it.
Oh, a couple of hunters on Yamnuska. I didn't know what they were. Got too close to them and bang!
Were they hunting ravens?
Colin hadn't considered the possibility. Well, they could have been, I guess. Clearly, Uriah was a very perceptive bird. Rain pattered down.
I've been hunted a lot,
Uriah said offhandedly. Colin looked puzzled. Really? Here in the park? Greta had told him that Jasper was in the park, just as Banff was. Well, that can't be right, Uriah. Uriah turned his good eye toward Colin.
Well, my young friend, perhaps it wasn't in the park. But you obviously know far more about these things than I do.
He turned away again. Colin didn't know what to say next. He was so embarrassed. He could imagine Greta lecturing him along the lines of, a traveling raven has to be tactful at all times. Uriah may have been insulted, but he resumed the conversation.
So, tell me what it is you want to know.
Well, I'm trying to find a particular mountain.
I know. I have been there.
You have? Colin's feet gripped the branch hard.
Of course. I have been everywhere.
But how did you know which mountain I'm looking for?
Oh, I have my ways. You don't even have to tell me the name.
It's the mountain with feathers.
Ah, indeed. The mountain with feathers. Yes, yes.
Colin's heart leapt. Uriah had been to the mountain with feathers. Now, if he could only provide directions to it. Uriah raised his head and ruffled out his neck feathers. He took a deep breath.
The mountain with feathers is a grand and glorious mountain. It is higher and more beautiful than any other. Its base is surrounded by dense forests of the deepest green. Its sides are covered with glaciers that shine in the sun. Its top is lost in the clouds.
He glanced at Colin. Colin was listening eagerly.
If you seek this great mountain, you must be pure of heart and strong of body. You must have spirit. Many ravens have tried, but few have succeeded.
He peered again at Colin, who was enthralled.
It requires a lifetime to reach the mountain with feathers.
He waved a wing in the air for emphasis.
A lifetime. And even so, for most of us, the trip is a failure. We begin at hatching when we know not where we are going or why. We continue through the innocence of youth. Ah, wonderful youth!
Here he looked knowingly at Colin.
But as we mature, we lose that innocence, and we start on the hard part of the journey through adult life. Through wind and storm, through beauty and ugliness, through happiness and grief. And then, when we reach the end of life, we see, still distant and unattainable in our final weakness, the great mountain that has been our goal.
A feeling as gray as the weather began creeping over Colin. The message had gone from inspiring to sad. In fact, Uriah himself seemed overcome with the sadness of it. He stopped speaking. His head drooped and his eye closed. Colin's darkening mood brought forth dark words. Uriah, do you think that the only way to reach the mountain with feathers is to die? The eye stayed closed.
Indeed, my friend.
And most ravens don't reach it, even so?
That is true.
But you said you have been there.
That is also true.
But...
I know. How can I still be alive if I have been to the mountain with feathers?
Yes, Uriah, how can you? The eye opened.
My life has been harder than most, Colin. I have been ill and injured and starved and frozen.
He ruffled out his neck feathers again.
I have known the hunger of the hard winter and the bitterness of the year without a summer. I have fallen from my perch in fever and been seized between the jaws of a coyote. Death has stalked me closely, Colin, and caught me on several occasions.
And you survived?
Yes, just barely. At the very last moment, strength flowed into my body and saved me.
Where did this strength come from?
From the trees themselves.
Colin had never heard anything like this. His anxiety deepened. Uriah, if I keep seeing visions of the mountain with feathers, does it mean that I am going to die? Uriah looked thoughtful.
It may, he said.
Soon?
Possibly.
How soon?
There is no way of telling.
But what can I do about all this, Uriah? Colin was despairing.
You can do nothing. What will be, will be. The trees may spare you. After all, they spared me. Everything is the will of the trees. If I'm lucky, when I die, the trees will send the great raven to take me to the mountain with feathers. If I'm lucky.
The great raven would take him to the mountain with feathers? Everything was the will of the trees? Colin grappled with these ideas. But much of what this old, half-blind bird was saying didn't make sense to him. Greta had told him that life went on after death in a different way, through seeds and such. And what Uriah was telling him didn't agree with any of his dreams. Yet the great raven herself had told him to pay attention to his dreams. Colin had never been so confused. Maybe the voices, that of the fog long ago, or the wind during the cold blow, or the great raven's weird pronouncements. Maybe they were all for naught. Maybe the world just didn't make sense in some very basic way, and no matter what you did, There was no point to it. Second sight, for example. What was it good for? Seeing ahead toward death, that's what it was good for. Sure, he had been able to save some lives with it, but what had it meant for him? He was no closer to answering the big question, the tormenting question, the question that was driving him to desperation. Where had he come from? Colin shivered in the rain. Water ran off the end of his bill and dripped away into the roaring depths of the gorge. Clearly, he had failed. Failed to find out where he had come from. Failed to find the mountain with feathers. Failed in everything. His whole life, what he could remember of it, was a failure. It was all so hopeless. Perhaps he would just stop all this futile searching. Perhaps he would just let go. Colin closed his eyes. His feet loosened their grip on the branch. He began to tilt forward. Chapter 13.
Chirrup!
Who was that? Colin opened his eyes. He was slipping off his perch in the dead pine above Moline Canyon. He grabbed on hard with his feet and straightened himself up.
Chirrup! Chirrup! Zeet!
The sound was coming from inside the gorge. It grew louder. Colin looked down to see what was making it. And there, barely visible on a ledge far below him, just above the churning water, was a bird. It was small and gray. Standing on the ledge, head held high, the bird began singing in earnest,
"Bazeet! Bazeet! Chirrup! 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 Bazeet! Bazeet!"
bringing forth a long, happy song. Colin couldn't understand all the words over the noise of the water, but he caught the gist. I am a dipper, and this is my home, the home that I love. Colin blinked. A bird living in a place like this?
Bazeet! Chirrup!
The dipper dived from its ledge into the roiling currents. Colin flinched. Surely it would drown. But a moment later the bird was back on the ledge, flexing its legs in a bobbing motion that sent the water streaming off its feathers. In its bill it held a water insect. Rather than eating the insect, the dipper flew with it down the canyon toward another sound Colin was now starting to hear. It was similar, but higher pitched. There was more than one voice.
"By the trees," Colin said aloud, "that bird must have nestlings in this canyon."
The realization brought him a feeling of wonder. Birds raising their young in a place like this. Little gray birds living in a place like this, singing happily amid the torrents. Truly, Colin affirmed to himself with growing delight, birds could live anywhere, could do anything. Birds could live in the bottom of Moline Canyon and sing about it. Birds were just, well, the best. And he, Colin, was a bird. A bird who had been slipping into a deadly reverie moments ago, but now a bird who felt as if he had just awakened. He looked over to Uriah, who was sleeping. He looked up into the fog, and suddenly he knew what he was going to do.
"Up!"
he yelled to the dripping canyon walls. "Up! Up! Up!" they echoed. Colin spread his wings and shot upward from his perch like a black rock flung from a volcano. Up! 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 He pulled hard against the fog, gaining elevation faster than he ever had before. His lungs set the pace. Inhale! Exhale! Inhale! Exhale! And his heart kept up, although it felt like it was coming loose in his chest. Up! 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 Then he burst through the cloud tops and into the sun.
"Free!" he cried. "I'm free!"
Yes, he was free. He was free of the fog. He was free of the gorge. He was free of Uriah. He was also free, he realized, of all the worries he had been carrying on this long journey. The frightful agony of not knowing had left him. In its place was the certain knowledge of his great avian heritage, the strength and joy of his wings, the comfort of just being a raven, alive, up in the sky. Now he could stop his frantic flapping. He leveled off and soared in the sunlight. He recalled something Greta had said last winter, during the flight before the coldest night, when she had told Zack that the reason to live was, how had she put it exactly? Oh, yes, the reason was to be part of all this. How true! Colin could now see clearly that the this she was referring to was the world of ravens. Her world and his world. And what a world it was. So rich in beauty. So rich in experience. So rich in knowledge. So rich in ugliness, too, and evil and pain and suffering. Yes, he had certainly suffered. But he had endured suffering. He had survived evil. He would undoubtedly encounter these things again, and gladly, for they were part of the world, the real world in which he lived. Colin felt satisfaction. He pictured himself falling numbly into Moline Canyon, his senses shut off, his mind paralyzed with self-pity. How silly! He found himself laughing. At that moment, something caught Colin's attention. Something out of the corner of his eye. There, off to the right, not so very far away. It's the mountain with feathers! Colin heard the sound of his voice croaking happily. The mountain with feathers! There it is! It's real! And so it was. Higher than its neighbors, reaching well above the clouds, the mountain with feathers was instantly recognizable. The sun glinted on its angled slabs, overlapping one another just like the feathers on a raven's wings, exactly as in Colin's dreams. Oh, yes, it's real, it's perfect, and I'm almost there! Then he heard another voice, in addition to his own. Well done, Colin, well done, said the great raven. Chapter 14. The cloud deck was breaking up as Colin flew toward the mountain with feathers. Except for some filmy stratus still clinging to the peak, it was now visible from base to top. He could see that it was carved from a single enormous block of limestone. The west face was the slabby side, a vast inclined surface of bare rock, recently wetted with rain and dark as a shadow. On the other side, Colin could see a glacier shining white in the sunlight. Rock on one side and ice on the other. Colin could not imagine more perfect symmetry. How should he approach the mountain with feathers? Colin chose the west side. Here he would probably find an updraft, and as he drew near the slabs, he felt himself lifted skyward as never before. He soared ecstatically, circling in the rising wind, feeling the power that abided in this peak. Far above the summit, black dots drifted among wispy bits of cloud. Ravens! In a few moments, Colin was among them. Greetings, Colin. You're just in time for the mythical flight. It was Angie, and here was Kootenai. Kootenai? Mythical flight? But... And so we finally meet, Colin C.C. The voice of the great raven, and a bird to go with it. Colin was surprised to see how ordinary she seemed. Ordinary, that is, until she looked at Colin. Her beautiful brown eyes were so clear, so deep, deeper even than Greta's, that it seemed to Colin that the knowledge of the ages must be stored there. Yes, this truly was the great raven. He wanted to speak, but he didn't know what to say. The great raven spoke instead. "It's all right to be tongue-tied, Colin. I imagine you'll be doing more listening than talking in the next little while anyway. Just let me say how pleased I am that you're here." A ripple in the airstream bounced the birds about. They made the most of it, croaking playfully. "Wing over! Yay! Immelmann! Immelmann! Well, let's go a little farther east and grab the downdraft. It's going to pack a wallop today." "Yes, let's do that," said the great raven. "But first, don't you think we ought to welcome Colin C.C.?"
"Aye, and that we should, G.R."
By the burr on the R, Colin could tell who was speaking. Sure enough, it was Boogs, the raven he knew from the Banff flock. What was Boogs doing here? And Angie and Kootenai? "Let's land at the loft and do this properly," the great raven suggested. All the birds immediately pulled in their wings and hurried downward. Colin could hardly keep up, they flew so well. The loft was a platform near the summit of the mountain with feathers, the only flat place on a knife edge of rock. On one side lay the slabs that Colin had circled beside. On the other, an equally steep slope of glacial ice fell away. Despite the westerly wind that rushed over the mountain, the air at the loft was calm. Colin fluttered as he dropped out of the updraft along with the other birds. 2 dozen strong, they formed a loose circle around the great raven. "Who wants to explain?" she asked.
"Oh, you do it," said Angie. "You've had the most practice." "Ha ha!"
The others echoed her laugh.
"All right, I will."
The great raven turned to Colin, who was looking both eager and fearful. "The first thing, Colin, is that there's no need to be frightened. We're not going to hurt you," she smiled. "Come close and look into my eyes." Colin looked, but from a safe distance. What he saw, kindness beyond words, limitless generosity, boundless love, brought him over in a single hop. "That's it. Now, keep looking into my eyes. Stare hard." He did. A peaceful feeling came over him. I feel sleepy," he said.
"You're supposed to," the great raven reassured him.
"Just let the sleepy feeling grow. Pretend that night is coming. It's a warm summer evening at Raven's End, after a day without a single cloud, and the wind feels soft. You're on your favorite roost. Everything is comfortable and warm. Your head is back under your wing, and you can feel the warmth spreading through your feathers, making you so sleepy." Her voice trailed off as Colin, head tucked away, seemed to fall asleep. The other birds had been watching intently. One of them whispered to the great raven,
"May we do it too?"
"Certainly." She turned her eyes toward the rest of the flock. Every bird stared into them, and in a few moments the loft was silent. The great raven, in her own special way, began to tell Colin's story. There were no words. Instead, there was a dream shared by all. Chapter 15. High on the south face of Yamnuska, 2 humans, 2 climbers, stood on a ledge.
"Last pitch," said one to the other. "That's got to be the top right up there. Want to lead it?"
I don't know, Colin. This looks weird. It's totally overhanging. Oh, there's not supposed to be anything this steep on the route, is there?"
"Who's to say? We've lost the guidebook."
"Sorry about that."
"Ah, no worries.
Remember when I dropped the guidebook off Castle Mountain? We got up okay.
But maybe we're not on the route, Col.
I'd say we have to be. Colin was looking up.
That crack is so obvious.
The other climber was also inspecting the crack. He craned his neck back.
Well, maybe that is the route. Really steep, though.
So you want to lead or not?
Well, no, really, I don't. And I don't like this belay. I mean, here we are, way up here, and I'm anchored on only one piton.
Colin glanced at a metal spike sticking out of the rock at waist level. He touched it. Flakes of rust fell away as he wiggled the ring in the end. Not good. But they had nothing to put in its place. It'll have to do, that's all. Colin's voice was firm. Look, the sun's setting, okay? We'll be trying to get down in the dark. He stepped away from the rope, piled about his feet. He checked the knot that tied him to one end of the rope. His partner was tied to the other.
You got me, Ted?
Yeah.
Ted glanced at the rope in his hands. His knuckles were scraped and scabby. He looked Colin in the eye. Be really careful, Col.
Not to worry, Ted. It's in the bag.
Colin began to climb up there in the late afternoon shadows. He found a handhold, swung up onto a tiny ledge, and balanced against the vertical wall, his nose to the rock. He could smell the rock. It was earthy, the odor of moss and lichen and cold stone. Colin's fingertips brushed across the rough surface, finding a hold here, a hold there. The toes of his rock-climbing shoes touched lightly, cautiously, seeking a nubbin, a hollow, a bit of cliff that sloped less steeply than the rest. One careful move at a time, Colin was gaining ground. His rope dangled down to Ted, who watched intently from the ledge, feeding the rope out to Colin as he tiptoed higher, higher. And here was the crack in the rock. It ran straight up to the sky. Colin could see the blue at the top of the crack, the top of the south face, the top of the mountain. It was so close. They were going to make it, if he could climb that crack. As wide as his thigh, the crack split a wall that leaned toward him, beyond the vertical. Colin stuck his arm into the crack. A bit of winter's chill lingered there, hiding from the August sun. Feeling around, Colin's hand bumped into a stone. The stone was wedged tightly in the crack, and just the right size to grab. The perfect handhold. He sighed in relief. This would make all the difference.
How's it look? Ted called up. Off with. But there's a chalkstone. Just have to get up high enough to stand on the thing.
Just. Colin leaned out on his arms, trying to rest his muscles before making the difficult move up and over the chalkstone. He was tired. Tired all over. He and Ted had been climbing since daybreak. Colin took a deep breath. He reached up and grabbed the chalkstone with his right hand. He pulled hard on it, feeling his body rise. Plenty of strength left in that arm. He pressed his lips together in a tight smile, getting ready for one of his great pleasures, doing something demanding and doing it well. Such was climbing, he thought. There was a challenge like this on every mountain, every cliff, every frozen waterfall, every... The chalkstone pulled out. He saw the wall rush back. His hand shot out, grabbing for the edge of the crack, but it was gone. He shouted, "Ted!" and saw the sky in a place it shouldn't be. Ted had the other end of the rope. Now it was up to Ted to save Colin's life. Having climbed upward a dozen difficult moves, Cullen was falling downward that same dozen. Then a dozen more before Ted could do anything about it. Ted braced himself. The weight came on the rope. A lot of weight, generated by the force of the fall. All that weight hit the little aluminum belay plate on Ted's climbing harness. It went click and stopped the rope from sliding through. The plate was attached to Ted, so the force now tugged at Ted's body. It jerked him forward. In the next instant, he would be hurled off the ledge and into space. But there was one hope left for Ted and Colin. Driven into the cliff beside Ted was the piton, an old rusty blade of steel. Ted had tied himself to it, and now it was about to receive the shock of two falling climbers. Would it hold? Perhaps it would. The great Brian Redman had driven that piton many years ago, when he had peered up at the overhanging rock and had told himself, "That crack looks too difficult. I'm going to work my way over to the right and check around the corner. But first I'm going to get a good solid peg in." So Brian Redman had hammered in the piton, ping, 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 until only the ring had stuck out. He had clipped his rope through it. Then he had traversed rightward. He had found a good hold over there, hidden around the corner, and he had climbed easily to the top. So he never had to climb the overhanging crack. Nor did he fall as he finished the climb, so he didn't have to put his piton to the test. But Colin and Ted were testing it now. All in an instant, the ring distorted under the strain, becoming an oval. The piton bent. It shifted forward in the crack. It held. This bit of metal, worth a couple of dollars in a mountaineering equipment shop, had done its job. Colin and Ted stopped falling. But all was not well. Colin was dangling on the cliff face, some distance below the ledge. And he was not moving.
"Colin, are you okay?"
No answer.
"Colin!"
No answer. Ted squinted down the cliff. He could see that Colin's yellow helmet had a big dent in the top. "He must have hit something," Ted said to himself. And then he saw the blood running from under Colin's helmet, dripping away in the wind, blowing back across the rock in red spatters. Ted tried to calm himself, to think about how he could get Colin back up to the ledge. Colin was so heavy, hanging there in that harness. The harness went around Colin's chest, and the nylon webbing squeezed his ribs. Under Colin's ribs were Colin's lungs, trying to breathe. Colin always climbed like the Europeans, in a chest harness. Ted caught himself speaking of Colin in the past tense. And well he should, for as he watched, he saw the harness working its way upward on Colin's body, creeping under his arms. He saw Colin's arms start to rise, helplessly.
"No, no! Colin, wake up! Keep your arms down!"
But the harness crept up and up until suddenly the arm shot straight overhead. Colin's body dropped through the web of nylon and fell free.
Chapter 16. Colin the Raven awoke with a twitch, as they always did from a dream in which he was falling. The other birds were affected the same way. Angie walked over and touched his bill, saying, "Great story, great story. Much more exciting than mine." She looked over to the great raven. "Fabulous, G.R. These dreams you do get better every time." "Thank you," the great raven replied.
He knew. Finally, after all this time, Colin knew where he had come from. The dream had been very clear, yet it was incredible. To have been a human climber who fell from Yamnuska? A flood of questions swept through his mind, but before he could sort the torrent into words, the great raven spoke. Colin, you are one of us. You have been one of us since the moment of your appearance as a raven, and you shall remain one of us as long as you live. She paused to let that sink in. And, like the rest of the mythical flock, you can live as long as you like. Colin's eyes had started to widen with her first statement, and they practically popped out at her second. As long as... I can live as long as... As long as you like, the great raven repeated. Colin, with membership in the mythical flock, comes the privilege of immortality. Colin opened his bill, but nothing came out. The great raven gave him a moment to absorb this vast idea, and none of the other birds interrupted. Then she continued, "It's like this, Colin. No aspiring mythical raven knows where she or he came from, and you haven't either until now. And it hurts. It hurts a lot. You suffered more than most, and I'm sorry. But it had to be. You are all the stronger for it." Some of the other birds nodded, saying, "Yes, yes," and "Quite so." Like all other mythical ravens, Colin, you started as something else. Lately, they've been starting as humans. Humans becoming ravens? This was impossible. When you were dead, you were dead. Something ate you. "Of course it sounds impossible," said the great raven, thereby reminding Colin that she could know his thoughts. "But that's the way it is. The trees are the ones behind it, and you know what sort of power they have. Impossible power. The power to make crazy-sounding things into real things." The swish of wind over the slabs nearby became a roar, taking her words away. Yet the breeze on the loft barely ruffled her feathers. Presently the gust passed. "Colin, you were very, very lucky. You were the one among many millions of humans given a chance to become mythical. I guess you just happened to fall off Yamnuska at the right time, when the trees were watching. The other human climber, the human who was my climbing partner, what happened to it?" "Your partner was rescued by other humans." The great raven looked admiringly at Colin. "And it's a sign of your character, Colin C.C., that you would want to know that." He lowered his head, embarrassed with the compliment, but honored all the same. "So how do you feel now?" Colin took a moment to think. What came to him was a question. "I feel very relieved," he said. "But I wonder if I could ask you something, Great Raven."
"Of course."
"What was it like for you before you knew where you came from?" The other birds tittered. "What a personal question." Colin looked mortified, but the Great Raven just chuckled.
Now, I'll bet everyone here would like to know that. Am I right?"
She looked around. The tittering had turned into expectation.
"I can remember when the trees first explained my origin to me. And they took their sweet time getting around to it. 1,000 years or so."
Colin gasped. How could she have stood it?
"Barely," she replied to his unspoken question. "But eventually the trees did tell me. They didn't make me from a human, you know. There weren't any humans back then. They made me from a dinosaur." She smiled. "I'll bet that's not something you hear in those great raven tales they tell in the mortal flocks." "No, indeed," thought Colin. "And what was a dinosaur?"
big lizard, sort of. Anyway, I've always felt that the trees made a mistake when they granted me immortality. It complicated things, both for them and for me. But they're a vain lot, the trees, and they wanted to keep their handiwork around. "This was our first," they'd say, showing me off. "Don't you think it's terrific?" And they'd congratulate each other. For a long time, I thought my only purpose was to feed their sense of superiority. My only purpose besides scratching their itchy limbs, of course. Here she gave a little snort of a laugh. But in time they left me alone. Just plain forgot about me, I guess. I had to go to them with my problem. Another gust whistled over the birds, forcing the great raven to pause. My problem was that my flock mates kept dying. She looked wistful. Worse, my nest mates. I'd have a mate for a few years. I had one for 20 years once. And then he would die. It just crushed me every time. I went back to the trees and demanded the right to die, too. No one laughed at this. But the trees, in their typical way, refused. "No," they said, "we like you alive." So that was it. I couldn't even kill myself. I tried. They'd haul me back. It was horrible. Another roar of wind over the slabs. But as you know, the trees are terribly clever, even if they are the most self-centered things in the world, and they came up with a pretty good solution. "What was that?" Colin asked. "You. All of you. All the immortal members of the mythical flock. From among you I have chosen my nest mate. Which reminds me," she said, turning to a distinguished-looking raven standing beside her. "Would you like to introduce yourself now, Archie?"
"Certainly. Greetings, Colin C.C. I am Archibald C.C., mate of G.R. here."
He touched her bill. She touched his, then turned again to Colin. "A raven needs a flock, too, and mine is the mythical flock. Unless you are careless, Colin, and I hope you're not, you can be part of the flock as long as you wish. That is to say, forever." "Forever." Colin smiled broadly. "Thank you," he said.
"Don't thank me. Thank the trees."
"Thank the trees? How can I,
"Just keep on scratching them. That's part of the deal. We mythicals get an awful lot of practice, so we do it best."
As the wind rose again, a gust of elation swept over Colin.
To live forever! To live forever and in the company of ravens such as this! Think of what he could learn!
"Oh, there's something I forgot to mention," the great raven said. "Something that you may find interesting. That bit of cleverness, the creation of the mythical flock, is what you hear hinted about in the great raven tales as the request. In fact, a fair bit of my story has escaped over the generations into the mortal flocks, in spite of me trying to prevent it. The trees warned me about that. They've seen what loose knowledge of immortality can do in other species. So the trees have made sure that the true nature of the request doesn't become known." Those were Greta's words almost exactly, Colin recalled. He wondered how much Greta knew of all this. Then it dawned on him that Greta might be a mythical raven. Of course, she had to be.
"But be aware, Colin, that even mythical ravens can be killed. And the trees won't bring you back if that happens. Mythical ravens are immune to aging and disease, and they have great healing ability. But a really severe injury can be fatal. That is why the trees create new mythicals occasionally. You've had some close calls, right?"
Colin nodded, but he said nothing. He noticed, though, that several of the other birds looked sympathetic. In fact, Most aspiring mythicals don't make it, the great raven continued. They have accidents along the way. We lose 100 potential flock members for every one we gain. But if a candidate mythical raven survives the first year, then there's a good chance the bird will be with the flock for a very long time. So we go ahead with the induction. She smiled at Colin. He looked back at those splendid eyes, grateful to have lived long enough to see them. Now he would have a chance to get to know this bird well. It was an exciting thought. So, I guess it's time for the welcoming, she concluded. Well, shall we induct Colin? The other ravens croaked their approval, and the circle closed around Colin and the great raven. She made the pronouncement. Colin Corvus Corax, we welcome you as the newest member of the mythical flock. She touched his bill, then turned to the others. Shall we have a motion? The other birds were quick to assent.
Yes, yes.
Hear, hear.
Oh, I love this. A new member.
As at Yamnuska, the flock moved in, covering Colin protectively with their black wings. The wheel of wings fluttered eagerly. And then, led by the great raven, the wings rose up in unison. The birds raised their heads high, and out came the flock call, Rock-a-taw! Colin's bill opened in disbelief. It was the same call used by the raven's enders. Chapter 17. Colin, now a full-fledged member of the mythical flock, was mobbed by the other birds. They all wanted to hear more of his story, and he wanted to hear theirs. He learned that Angie and Kootenai were both mythical, but they had not been humans in their previous lives. They were too old. Like the great raven, they had lived before the trees had invented humans.
What were you and Angie before you became mythical? He asked Kootenai.
Oh, I was a sort of armadillo. Well, Angie now, she was a really weird sea creature. I can hardly even pronounce the name. Amyloid cephalope or something like that. Aminoid cephalopod, Kootenai. I've told you 1,000 times. Literally, said Kootenai, and I'll never remember it. Anyway, the whole lot are extinct now. Except for Angie, of course, who's kind of extinct, too. Angie pecked him. Boogs, the Banff Raven, welcomed him warmly.
It's a real treat. So it is, seeing you here, laddie. I was surely hoping you'd make it, so I was.
But, Boogs, why didn't you just tell me where the mountain with feathers was?
Och, it's not allowed, laddie. You have to get there by yourself. Mind, I was kind enough to give you a wee hint, was I no?
Well, yes. And it saved me from wasting my time going west from Castle Mountain, which I surely would have done otherwise.
Aye, weel, I'm glad I helped you then.
And where did I
meet my end as a human? It was daft. I fell through a snow cornice, climbing Whitney a rope.
So you were a climber, too?
Aye, and with a wife and wee babe at home.
He looked sad. But can you visit them? Colin asked.
Och, indeed I can, Boogs replied, brightening. I'm for making the flight to their house in a day or two.
But they can't know it's you.
Well, no, they can nae, that's true. And it wouldnae be proper for them to. But it doesn't stop me from keeping an eye on them, eh?
One of the other birds hopped up to Colin.
Oh,
Colin CC, I'm Laurel CC from the Squamish flock. She touched his bill with hers. Colin responded in the proper way.
Oh,
Laurel CC. He returned the touch. Where is Squamish? I've never heard of it.
Oh, it's about 10 days southwest of here, if you fly.
10 days? If you fly? What?
Hey, far out to meet you, Colin. I'm John John CC from the Calgary flock.
Calgary flock? But I thought this was the mythical flock.
Howdy, Colin, say,
said a bird with a peculiar drawly accent.
I'm Rick CC from the Pike's Peak flock.
And so it went. He tried to remember all the names, but there were so many that he quickly lost track. Oh, no, he thought. They would think he was a boor if he couldn't remember. His head was spinning. The great raven saw his worried expression, looked briefly into his mind, and understood immediately. Oh, just look at him, CC's. Don't you know how he feels? How you felt the first time?
For sure, said John John, the raven from Calgary. He's coming to grips with a whole new plane of existence here. Immortality is kind of a heavy trip to lay on someone all at once. It can throw a bird off.
Several of the other ravens giggled. Colin cringed. The great raven addressed the whole flock. I'll tell you what, CC's. Why don't all of you be off for a while so Colin and I can talk one-to-one, okay? Just for a while, to get him all sorted out. They didn't want to go, but they went. And they didn't go far, just out of earshot at the other end of the loft. Colin, the insatiable asker of questions, who was now overwhelmed with answers, said, Thank you, Great Raven. It was really getting to be a bit much. You can just call me G.R., Colin. Everyone else does. Okay, G.R. Now, you're wanting to ask me why the trees chose humans to become mythical ravens, right? Well, yes. Colin was already formulating his next question. Where did she get her power to know what other ravens were thinking? Well, Colin, the great raven began, I'll get to your second question in a moment. But about the humans. The trees don't even like humans much. After all, humans cut down trees. Inventing humans was the worst mistake the trees ever made. But they know that only a very intelligent creature can be turned into a raven, and when humans came along, it was only natural to use them. After all, humans are the third smartest things in the world, next to ravens and the trees themselves. Humans are also a lot like ravens in some ways. Humans can eat almost anything, same as us. And they aren't happy unless they're amused, same as us. They have great memories, perhaps even better than ours, and so on. But why not just pick ravens in the first place? It would be easy for the trees to make a raven immortal, wouldn't it? Yes, of course, but not very kind. Not very kind? Most despairing mythicals don't survive their learning period. And, Colin's mind was racing ahead. And the trees thought it would be cruel to put a raven through that? All that worry and uncertainty, and then another death? Yes. The trees are pretty obtuse sometimes, but they do care about ravens. It just seemed improper to make them suffer. Besides, she said, they tried a few ravens early on and botched it. Made me terribly unhappy, and I sure let them know. So they started using humans. Humans don't matter much to the trees. Why did they pick climbers like Boogs and me? Well, climbers are the most suitable kind of humans to be made into ravens. Think about it. You know a fair bit about climbers, don't you? Yes, I do. Colin recalled his memories of John and Linda and the many other climbers he had watched on Yamnuska. They seemed to love the mountains as much as he did, and they certainly liked ravens. Exactly, the great raven continued. The trees thought that climbers would really enjoy being able to fly among the peaks. Cullen remembered his second question. G.R., how are you able to...
How can I do the things I do? Speak to you from wherever I am? Know what you're thinking? All that?
Yes, all that. Did the trees give you those powers?
No, the trees don't give anything away they don't have to. I had to learn to do those things myself.
You did?
Well, let me put it this way. If you had lived as long as I have, you'd have learned a few tricks, too.
So, any raven can do what you do?
I imagine. They just have to stumble on the techniques. I say stumble because these things aren't at all obvious. I mean, look how long it took the humans to learn how to fly.
Humans could fly?
Cullen wanted to pursue this subject, but the other birds were getting restless. Some were edging over to listen in. Quickly, he began to ask the great raven the one other question he had to know the answer to right now.
G.R., it's about Greta. Is she...
At that moment, another raven arrived at the loft. Cullen shrank away in horror. It was Zygadina C.C. Chapter 18. The great raven's eyebrow tufts went up in a flash. Zygadina, you know you're not supposed to come here.
Oh, is that so?
Zygadina replied sweetly, turning her head to the side.
And who says?
It was decided long ago, Cece.
Well, I'm asking for an exception.
No exceptions. Some of the other birds had moved backward to the edges of the loft. They seemed just as afraid of Zygadina as Cullen was. Others in the flock were moving closer, tufts raised. Cullen now realized what his second sight had told him the day before. That strong feeling of impending evil must have been Zygadina following him. But he wondered how Zygadina could still be alive. Somehow she had overcome her injuries from the falcon attack. Her left wing showed no sign of being broken. Her bill was now healed. Her plumage, her legs. She looked to be her usual, beautiful, deadly self. How could she have done that? The great raven spoke quietly to Cullen, but she kept her eyes on Zygadina. Just stay cool, Cullen. This particular bird was kicked out of the mythical flock for bad behavior. But she comes back from time to time. We know how to deal with her.
So that was it. Zygadina was mythical. No wonder she had such incredible power. No wonder she healed so quickly.
I have my reasons, Zygadina was saying. This had better be good, Archibald responded.
Oh, it is, it is.
She preened a feather that was slightly out of place.
It's about this Cullen C.C. you seem to care for so much.
Cullen cowered. What was going to come next?
He's not what you think he is.
The great raven sighed. She was well acquainted with Zygadina's lies. Out with it.
He's an impostor.
Oh, Zygadina, the great raven began, trying not to laugh. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Zygadina's bill flashed out and caught the great raven by the throat.
Wah!
Archibald started for Zygadina, but she tightened her grip and quickly dragged the great raven away from him.
Keep your distance, or I'll kill this bird right now, she hissed, forcing the great raven's neck into a nasty twist.
Archibald scoffed. Zygadina, you know you can't kill the great raven. The trees will just bring her back.
Oh, and are you sure?
Archibald stepped back. No one moved, for fear that Zygadina would actually break the great raven's neck. No one moved, except for Colin.
Kill me instead, he said, stepping forward. You always wanted to kill me, Zygadina.
Oh, not as much as I've wanted to kill her, she replied, clamping down harder on the great raven's windpipe. The way she's treated me.
Oh, come, come, Colin's eyes said to Zygadina. She blinked. Look at me. Zygadina's eyes met Colin's. Surely you'd like to keep looking at me. His eyes continued, locked with those of Zygadina. Surely you'd like to keep looking at me, wouldn't you? Zygadina kept staring at him. And now don't you think you'd like to come over here where I am? Yes, yes, I would like to come over there where you are. Zygadina's voice had gone strangely flat. She was loosening her grip on the great raven. Well, then, please come closer, much, much closer. I am waiting. Yes, I am coming. Zygadina's bill opened as she spoke, and the great raven pulled away. Instantly, several ravens seized Zygadina. Kootenai had her by the throat. Angie grabbed one of her legs. The bird named Rick grabbed the other. Zygadina extended her wings as if to fly, but other members of the mythical flock jumped on her, dug in their claws, and held her down. The great raven was getting back on her feet. Oh, my! Oh, how could I have been so stupid? Oh, Zygadina! She stretched her neck and shook her feathers back into place. She looked toward her worried nestmate. I'm okay, Archie. Oh. Now, we're even. We're even. Let me go, GR.
Let you go?
I'll stay away from now on.
You bet you will, the great raven said gruffly. She spread her wings and closed her eyes. Then she lowered the left wing only, curving it in an unusual way. Zygadina disappeared. Kootenai's bill snapped shut on the empty space that had been Zygadina's neck a moment before. The bills of Rick and Angie likewise closed on thin air. The three birds who had been standing on Zygadina's back dropped onto the ones that had been holding her. There was a flurry of feathers and claws as the ravens untangled themselves. Then they looked at each other and started to laugh.
That was quick. Here 1 minute, gone the next.
Way to go, GR.
By golly, Angie, did I look as funny as you hanging onto a bird's leg that wasn't there?
Well, not nearly as funny as the bunch up on her back. What were you guys thinking? Planning to mate, maybe?
Then one of the birds turned to Colin and looked quite serious. Colin, how did you do that? That thing with your eyes? The laughter ceased.
I learned it from a lynx.
A lynx?
Yes. Colin was aware of every bird in the flock staring at him incredulously. It just sort of happened, he said. I didn't really think about it.
He was fumbling for further explanation when the great raven broke in.
Friends, never mind how he did it. I, for one, am just glad that he did.
Yes, and we are all as grateful to Colin as GR is. The voice was Archibald's. He hopped up to Colin. Many thanks to our newest flock member. Shall we tell him what we think of him?
Rock-a-taw,
came the universal reply.
Chapter 19. Yes, I'm fine. I'm just fine. The great raven was trying to reassure the mythical flock. She decided to change the subject. Some birds will do absolutely anything to get revenge. Zygodina is one such. Archibald spoke next.
You know, a bird like Zygodina, and thank the trees there aren't many, a bird like that operates under a different set of rules than we do. She cares only for herself. Worse than that, she has to have power over everybody else. And she knows the way to get it.
What way is that?
Ah, Laurel. Lucky you, never having had to deal with Zygodina. Well, she kills ravens and crows and turns their flesh into a poison. She calls it magic meat. Her victims take more and more of it, and after a while they'll do anything to get it. Anything at all. Even killing their flock mates.
Several birds shook their heads in disgust.
Of course, this magic meat eventually makes Zygodina's slaves so sick that they can't serve her. Then she kills them. And she uses them for more magic meat. She's vicious, utterly vicious. As she proved once again today.
Laurel looked astonished. She turned to the great raven. And you let this bird live? You just sent her away?
Yes. We could easily have killed her just now. But I would never allow it. For one raven to kill another is evil. It's evil in the same way that Zygodina herself is evil. And to kill the killer just spreads the evil further. It spreads and spreads. I have seen it, and I know.
Laurel still wasn't convinced. But you said that you already banished her.
Yes, I did. We all did. Threw her out of the flock by unanimous agreement.
But she came back.
She has come back several times, claiming to be reformed. Well, not that she couldn't be, you know.
Colin thought of Garth.
But she has lied, just as she did now.
So where did you send her this time?
The great raven chuckled. someplace that will keep her out of our feathers for a very long time. Away from every other raven in the world, actually. Although it's kind of unfair to the penguins.
Penguins? What?
Oh, I sent her off to Antarctica.
Chapter 20. The long light of late afternoon lay warm on the mountain with feathers. Colin was talking with Angie and Kootenai.
You two didn't give a thing away when I came to Jasper, did you?
Of course not, Kootenai said. We've been through this before. We've seen other aspirants heading for the mountain with feathers.
But why don't the locals know about it?
Oh, they do, Angie said. They fly here all the time. I even take them. The soaring is really terrific, don't you think? But they know the mountain by a different name, she stated it for Colin. And the great raven makes sure they never see her or the mythical flock. It works out fine. Uriah has them all convinced that the mountain with feathers is the place where ravens go after they die. And we play along with that.
Then why did you send me to see Uriah?
Uriah is an interesting character. I'll tell you his whole story sometime. Or you can ask him yourself. Anyway, we thought Uriah would test the strength of your convictions. And he did.
Did he ever? I almost wound up in the bottom of Maligne Canyon, Angie.
Angie stayed unruffled. Yeah, I heard. We weren't expecting that, and we're sorry it happened.
She touched his bill with hers.
Well, I got here anyway, Colin said, accepting the apology.
Angie looked at Kootenai.
You know, Coot, we've got to go. It's time for the flight back at Jasper.
should I come along? Colin asked.
Sure, if you like, Kootenai answered. But why not stick around here? Archie and GR might let you roost with them.
The pair flew off.
Anyone up for a flight? Asked the great raven. By way of an answer, all the remaining birds immediately took to wing. The mythical flock, Colin among them, soared along the west face of the mountain with feathers. A cloud-rich sunset glowed over the Canadian Rockies, coloring everything red-orange. Colin flew beside the great raven and her mate.
"Where do we roost?" he asked.
"Oh, most of the mythicals go home," Archibald replied.
"Home?"
"Yeah. Didn't you notice that they were all from different mortal flocks?"
"Yes, but I don't know why."
G.R. likes it that way. Well, tell him why, G.R.
Well, if you're immortal, you learn a lot as the years go by. And that's good for ravens generally, if the knowledge gets passed along. So I make sure it does. A lot of mythicals are Maine ravens, but not the one at Yanuska. She had known what Colin was going to ask next. Archibald broke in. "Hey, Colin. G.R. and I usually roost here on the mountain, and we'd be pleased to have you join us. Especially after what you did for us today. Eh, G.R.?" The great raven agreed. "Well, of course, but I'm a little sore in the throat," she coughed. "So we'll have to limit the questions, okay? Besides, even mythical ravens need to sleep, especially new ones." Colin was, in fact, feeling very tired. "Would you please answer a question for me right now?"
"My pleasure."
"All these mythical ravens I met seem to come from very far away, way too far to get back before dark."
"Well, most of them don't fly here. They ask, and I bring them."
"You bring them? How do you do that?"
"Same way I sent Zygadina off to cool her claws south of Tierra del Fuego. I kind of bend the world a little."
Colin was trying to bend his mind around this idea. The great raven tried to explain.
"It's something I learned to do quite recently, just a few thousand years ago. You do it with space and time and..."
She looked at Colin, who was twitching with confusion.
"Let's talk about it another day, my dear."
Colin shook his head, trying to clear it. "Will you be able to send me back to Yamnuska?"
"Certainly. And when you want to visit, just ask. Sometimes I'll have to say no. Too big a crowd here already. But usually it's no problem. You know how to get in touch with me, right?"
Sort of. I just think about you. Without trying to think about you?"
"Yes, you'll learn how to do it. And it helps to non-think of the mountain with feathers, too. That way the signal comes in stronger."
Most of the other ravens had left the mythical flight by now. Colin hadn't realized they were leaving, but he just happened to be watching when Boogs departed. Boogs didn't fly away. He simply called,
"Aye, and fare thee well, G.R.,"
then winked out of existence. The great raven had curved her left wing. "I can't believe all the amazing things you can do, G.R.
"Oh, it's not so much. Whales, for example. You know about whales? Biggest fish in the sea, although they aren't really fish, but never mind. Whales can talk to each other all the way across the ocean. And they're mortal." She smiled, thinking about the long-distant squeaks and whistles of the whales. She liked to listen in on the whales.
Colin had no idea what a whale was, and only a vague notion of the sea. He interrupted the great raven's thoughts with yet another question. "I'm sorry, G.R., but there's something else."
"Okay, well, let's make this the last question for now, Colin."
"It's awfully nice of you," Colin said as politely as he could.
I was surprised to hear the flock call.
Ah, Rakata, the motion of the mythical flock. You know it, don't you?
Yes, I do. It's the same one we use at Raven's End.
Does that surprise you?
Well, yes. Aren't all the flock calls different?
Well, that's true, Colin, they are. Which should tell you something about the Raven's End flock.
The Raven's Enders are mythical?
This was intriguing, but it didn't make sense.
No, no, the Raven's Enders are mortal. The reason we mythicals use the Raven's End call is more obvious than that. Think about it. He thought, and moments later he had the answer. The great raven knew it as soon as he did, of course.
Colin, you delight me!
She touched his bill with hers. Yes, that's right. Yamnuska is where I came from. I was the original raven of Raven's End. Pretty soon we had a flock there, and we invented the idea of the motion way back then. I just kept it for the mythical flock.
Oh, that brings up a really important question. Colin had almost forgotten. He held his breath, hoping the great raven would answer it.
Very last one, Colin, okay? Someone's trying to contact me.
Colin let his breath out. I really appreciate this. What I need to know is why Greta isn't here.
Oh, Greta. The great raven looked pained. Greta is not mythical, Colin.
Not mythical, but...
I know, she seems mythical. She knows a lot about us, too. She really wants to be mythical, and I can't blame her. She'd make a great mythical raven. Remember that argument I was telling you about? The argument between Greta and me? Well, I've tried to get the trees to grant her honorary mythical status several times. But they won't do it. She blames me for not trying hard enough, I guess. But she doesn't know the trees like I do. I don't want to get their back branches up over this. We've been through it before. Greta's not the first bird to discover the mythical flock.
The great raven looked wistful. Then she smiled at Colin.
Greta had you picked immediately, kiddo.
Kiddo, a term Greta used, Colin recalled.
But how could she find all this out? About you and about mythical ravens and all that.
Greta is the smartest bird I have ever known, Colin. Smarter than me, that's for sure. I've had eons to figure all this stuff out. Greta has done it in a single lifetime.
Colin felt admiration for Greta spreading warmly through his wings. Oh, how he loved that bird. When he got back, he would tell her so.
So that explains why she looks so old and the real mythicals don't?
Yes. Greta must be, let's see now, I'll have to add this up, about 50 years old. She might be the oldest raven around right now, among the mortal flocks.
The great raven seemed distracted for a moment. Then she turned to Colin with a troubled expression.
That bird I was talking about, the one who was trying to contact me? It was Greta herself. She said she's been having trouble reaching me, and she was glad we thought of her just then, or she might not have been able to get through at all.
The great raven hesitated. She looked greatly distressed. Colin, I'm going to send you home. Greta says she's dying.
Chapter 21. The great raven had curved her wing. Everything in Colin's world had gone brown for a moment. The same sort of brown he saw in the great raven's eyes. And then he was soaring over the summit of Yamnuska. Bands of pink and purple clouds, the glowing filaments of day's end, decorated the mountain front from horizon to horizon. But no ravens played in the sunset there.
Colin tucked his wings and dived for Raven's End. There he found them. Zack, Molly, Scratch, Wheedle, Marg, Sarah, Brendan, Garth, and the main raven all stood in a circle. At the center was Greta. She lay on her side, with one wing partly extended. Her eyes, her wonderful eyes, Colin thought, so much like those of the great raven, were shut. No one was speaking. No one was moving a feather. Colin landed quietly a few hops away and walked grimly over. Colin! Molly saw him first. Oh, Colin! Is she dead? Colin stepped through the circle of birds. They blinked as they recognized him. Marg touched his bill. We don't know, she said, looking down at Greta. She hasn't moved since sundown, but I could hear her breathing until just a moment ago. Too late, Colin thought. Too late. Colin? Greta opened her eyes. They were clouded. Ah, Greta. Oh, Greta. Colin? She took a breath with each half of his name. I'm so glad you're back. Oh, did you see the... He knew what she was unable to say in front of the flock. Yes, Greta, I saw her. I saw them all. They took me in. Oh, that's so grand, Colin. Greta closed her eyes. So grand. Colin turned to Scratch. What happened to her? Oh, it's a crying shame, Colin, it really is. She took sick not long after you left. Told us it was her lungs, like. Said they was just too old, eh? Said they was gonna quit working, like. And sure enough, that's what's happened. Greta took several wheezy breaths before she could speak again. Her words were labored.
I guess this is it. Old Greta's off to the ants.
Marg couldn't help herself.
It's okay, Marg. The ants have had to wait way too long already.
She coughed again.
And the way I feel right now, oh, that hurts. I'm happy to go.
Marg closed her bill. It hung down. So did that of every other bird in the flock.
Before I die, here's what I want you to know.
She gasped, and her wing twitched.
So, listen up, CCs.
They listened as never before.
The main raven. The main raven's real name is... His real name is...
Greta! The main raven's eyes were wide in astonishment. How could you? She smiled.
Oh, Emmer, you know I really wouldn't do that to you. Just a last joke, okay? I did love making jokes.
The main raven lowered his head and turned it away. Greta opened her eyes and spoke again. Her voice was stronger than before, and what she said came out all at once. It took any strength she had remaining. The feathers on her breast shook with every word.
CCs, you live in the most beautiful of all worlds. Enjoy it. while you may, for we are here only for a little while. Be kind to each other, and watch out for each other. And Colin, this is meant for Colin. Where is he? I can't see him any longer.
I'm right here, Greta, right beside you.
Colin, do you remember Pekinus?
Yes, Greta, of course I do, and all the other things we talked about.
So you won't forget all those things?
Everything you taught me, Greta, I'll never forget.
Ravenness. There's ravenness, Colin, at Raven's End. Lots of ravenness.
Indeed there is, Greta. We will make sure it goes on, and on, and on. Greta closed her eyes.
Take care. Take care of these birds, Colin. I've loved them so well.
And we have loved you, Greta. Colin's bill was quivering. He touched it to hers.
Goodbye, all. Oh, Weasel Widgets, this is it. Goodbye, GR.
Her bill opened a little wider.
Rock! Rock! Rock!
Greta's wings spread themselves slightly, and she lay still. The other birds knew the time had come.
Craw, craw, craw.
Through it all, and over the sound of his own sobs, Colin distinctly heard the voice of the great raven. It trembled.
Goodbye, Greta. Goodbye, my dear. Oh, I'm going to miss you so much.
The voice broke, and it blended with the others in the flock. Chapter 22. The Last One. Many years have passed. Some of Zack and Molly's nestlings are still raising their own broods on Yamnuska, but most have lived out their lives, as have Molly and Zack and the rest of their generation. All but one. It is late in the day, and the sun lies low over the front ranges of the Canadian Rockies. Near the top of Yamnuska's south face, we hear a familiar sound.
On belay, John.
Keep an eye on me, Linda. This looks kind of tricky. John steps up from a ledge onto vertical rock.
Yeah, that's what everyone says about it. This is where that guy fell off and died, remember? About 20 years ago? Fell out of his harness.
Thanks for reminding me. John steps back down to the ledge.
Sorry.
Linda looks worried. You want me to check the guidebook?
Not a bad idea. Is it handy?
Got it right here. Linda reaches into her small rock-climbing pack and extracts a slim volume. If it weren't for the tape all over it, the book would be falling apart. She turns the dog-eared pages and reads.
It says, step right around a corner and feel for a sharp but good handhold.
Whatever that means.
Alternatively, climb the difficult overhanging wall above the belay.
I'll pass, says John. That's how that guy got killed. He peers upward.
Sure, off right has to be the way to go.
Straight up looks about 2 grades harder than anything I'd care to lead this afternoon.
Whatever you think. Anyway, I've got you.
John steps back up from the security of the ledge to the small holds on the wall. His nose is close to the stone,
and he must hang on with both hands to avoid falling over backward. He moves to the right and notices a piton there. The piton protrudes from an outside corner as if driven into the edge of a building. John can't see past the corner. He reaches around it with his right arm, feeling for holds. His fingers find only blank rock.
"Gee, it seems unlikely over that way," he reports.
His voice falters.
"Take your time, John."
"Yes, my dear.
Hey, I found it." "Found what?"
"Well, that hole they talked about in the guidebook."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah. Sharp but good is exactly right. I can't see it, but it feels like the edge of an axe. I'm almost afraid to pull on it. Might lose my fingers." Hanging onto the mystery hold with his right hand, John picks at his climbing gear with his left. He mutters to himself, "Big move coming up. Believe I'll just get something in beside this old peg." Jingle, jingle, he tries various items in the crack. Small cam might go in. Nope, too big. Maybe a size 3. Aha, perfect placement. Then he calls down to Linda. "A little slack, please."
"Here you go."
The sound of rope sliding against rock. A click. "Okay, I'm going to step around the corner and see what I'm hanging on to."
"Fine by me."
John swings his right leg past the edge of buff-colored limestone. His foot brushes the rock beyond, searching. It finds a hold at knee level. He brings the rest of his body around the corner, ducking his head under an overhang. He looks down.
"Hoo-wee! Check this out when you're up here, Linda. You can see all the way to the deck. Clear drop."
"Let's not do any dropping, okay?"
John now has a view of what lies ahead of him. He likes what he sees. He pulls on the sharp hold and brings his other foot around. Out of Linda's sight, he calls back.
"Absolutely gorgeous move. Looks hard, but really isn't. You're gonna love it."
"How's the continuation?"
"Piece of cake."
"Good going, John."
The rope pays out faster now. A few minutes later, Linda hears John's voice from the top.
"Off belay. Belay off."
Soon the rope tugs gently at Linda's waist, and she follows her climbing partner's path up and rightward toward the vertical edge of rock. She removes the gear John has placed in the crack. She feels for the secret hold, but her reach is shorter than John's, and she can't locate it. She inches up under the stone ceiling, where her arms must bear more of her weight. Her muscles are tired from climbing all day. She cannot cling this way for long.
"Keep me tight,"
she shouts to John. He takes up the slack in the rope. She feels around the corner again, and this time she can just barely touch a hold that might be the right one. She can't see it, though, and she can't get her whole hand on it. Linda's strength is fading. She must decide what to do, and soon. She takes a deep breath and lets go with her left hand, throwing her off balance momentarily. Then she stretches her right hand toward the hold. Her fingers close and lock onto the blade of rock.
Whew!
She swings around the corner as John did. She takes a look straight down to the base of the cliff, far below.
"What an incredible place to be," she says softly to herself.
Then she follows the rope to the summit of Yamnuska. John is waiting for her there in the last of the day's sunlight. His helmet is off, and his hair is gray.
Oh, John, what a fine climb, Linda says, sitting down beside him. He kisses her. She kisses him back. She takes off her pack and gets out their water bottle. Two swallows left, one for you and one for me. She tilts the bottle and drinks. Her knuckles are scuffed, but she has lost no skin. Her hands are tough from a summer of climbing the rock of the Rockies. John points out a large black bird soaring beside the south face.
There's that raven again.
Do you suppose it's the same one we keep seeing on these yam climbs?
Well, you're the one who says you can tell the ravens apart.
Just one, John. I can tell just one. But I know it really well. I can tell by its eyes.
Here it comes. Have a look.
The raven coasts by the climbers. It has spent the afternoon drifting contentedly in the updrafts. Now it has decided to land on the summit and enjoy the happy feelings it senses in the human sitting there. It lifts its wings high, flares the feathers at the tips, and drops onto a boulder near the climbers. It regards them, first with one eye, then with the other.
That's the one, John!
Oh, come on.
No, really. Look at his eyes. Look at his eyes.
John looks. Gee, you know, Linda, there is something about those eyes.
See? That's the one, John. That's him.
She digs into her pack and finds some raisins loose on the bottom. It is the only food that she and John have left. She holds it out. The raven stands there. A feather on its back flips up and down in the breeze. It won't come closer. It recognizes these humans, and it would be easy to hop over and accept the gift. But there are some rules a raven never breaks. Besides, the raven knows that the food will be thrown to it shortly. Linda tosses the raisins to the raven. The raven picks up as much of the offering as it thinks polite. It isn't hungry. It will leave the rest for some other creature. With a mild thank-you croak, Colin Corvus Corax spreads his wings and rises off the boulder into the warm wind. He will make his way back to Raven's End. The others will be waiting for him to announce the evening flight. Here are the book's acknowledgments. Many thanks to Lawrence Ormsby of Marana, Arizona, who kindly gave permission to use his dramatic drawings of ravens in the illustrations and title spread. The backgrounds have been made from my own photographs. To David Brislintz of Lutzen, Minnesota, whose wonderful photo of a raven in flight graces the cover. To JCM Digital Images, which supplied the flying raven video that I used for the flipbook animation. To Amber Hayward and Toby Gadd, who read the manuscript and made many useful comments. To Naoko Gadd, who provided essential information about the publisher of the Japanese edition of the book. To Shura and Mike Galbraith, who gave the character Boogs his Scottish accent. To Bernd Heinrich for writing Mind of the Raven, the best book on these amazing birds. To members of the Calgary Mountain Club, for whom Yamnuska is a favorite place. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, CMC climbers gave yams surrounding many of the geographic names in the story, including several from J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. And especially to Sia, my nestmate, for her helpful suggestions, including the idea for the flipbook, for her eagle-eyed editing, and for her patience. Other books by Ben Gadd. An Erogenous Life, Memoir and Reader, published by Corax Press, 2017. Operation Bo Athabasca,
The Geological Survey of Canada Takes on the Rockies. Published by Canmore Museum and Geoscience Center, 2012. Canadian Rockies Geology Road Tours. Corax Press, 2008. The Canadian Hikers and Backpackers Handbook. Whitecap Books, 2008. The Yam, A History of Climbing on Yamnuska. Co-authored with Chick Scott and David Dornian. Rocky Mountain Books, 2003. Of Rocks, Mountains, and Jasper, A Visitor's Guide to the Geology of Jasper National Park. Co-authored with Chris Yorath. Published by Dundurn Press and the Geological Survey of Canada, 1995. The Rockies, Canada's Magnificent Wilderness. Photos by Paul Lally and John Winnie. Published by Firefly Books and Beautiful America, 1992. Bankhead, the 20-year town. Published by Parks Canada and the Coal Association of Canada, 1989. Handbook of the Canadian Rockies. Corax Press, 1986. Second edition, 1995. And my first book, Climbing at Wasut Slabs, Rocky Mountain Books, 1980. And just a note, Raven's End was originally published by McClelland and Stewart in 2001, with subsequent editions in the U.S., Germany, Italy, Denmark, the Netherlands, and Japan.